Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Carpcast. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing fine. And yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Pretty quiet week. I was away in Nottingham at the weekend playing poker, I think, for a Sky televised competition. I've got to go back next weekend, playing for stupid amounts of money if I win it. I've got a lot, about 200 professional poker players to beat first, so I'm not retiring just yet. I think there'll be a Carpcast 4 anyway.
Oh, jolly good. I don't want to be left all alone just yet.
It's been well received, the Carpcast. We've had a few thousand listens now. Bear in mind, we're only on SoundCloud. We haven't got this onto iTunes yet. That should be imminent. There's a lot of faffing about you have to do to actually get it up there.
Yeah, there's more hoops to jump through than I ever thought. But with the feedback we've had so far via the Facebook and the Twitter, it's been positive. It's been encouraging. And
Very encouraging, yeah. Messages from all sorts of well-known anglers, A, offering their services for interviews, which is great because they were all on our wish list, and just saying what a breath of fresh air it is. You know, Ian McMillan in particular, who's going to be on in the near future. Ting Tong, as you may be better known, some of you. Yeah, he seemed really excited about it. He kept relaying messages to me as he was listening with his missus. Says I've got a hypnotic voice, which, you know, I know he loves me.
But there's a bit of a man crush going up there, I'm sure there is.
He's got a few man crushes. I'm way down the list on on Ian's list. So yeah, it's been well received by everybody. We're really chuffed, you know, as long as people keep liking it, keep listening to it and giving us feedback, we'll keep doing them. Yep, keep listening, keep following us, keep giving us feedback, and we'll keep doing it.
We will. Before we move on, I'd just like to say hi to the American listeners. I've posted the link on the American forum. I've got a set of 10 questions to answer. Doing a bit of an interview for the North American Carp Anglers magazine, which I never thought I'd do, but I'm quite pleased to be doing that for you.
I had a look on SoundCloud. We've got all the insights. We can see where people are listening from all over the world. We've had some funny ones, you know, places like Chile and stuff.
Really?
Yeah. I'm guessing the Chile one was probably Joe Morgan, actually, because I know he's out that way. Maybe not. I don't know. But there was a hell of a lot of listens from America. So, yeah, hello to all the American people. And, you know, I hope some of our carp gossip's getting over there and keep us informed on the American carp scene. And we can have a chat about that as well.
Definitely. There's a lot of it's a blossoming scene over in America. I think they've got a long way to go. But I know from what the messages I've had backwards and forwards, quite a few of the big companies have been mentioned to the making inroads to the American market, which is, if it really takes a foothold, it's got to be enormous.
Well, fishing and hunting's always been massive over there, and you know they've had the carp. I believe they were kind of nuisance fish, weren't they? Like they weren't considered like a worthy species to go and catch for a lot of years. But you know, as we know from Europe, they're great fun to catch. You know, they're good fun to fight. They're you know, tricky to outwit, and it's a great sport. So it was only a matter of time, I think, before they really got onto it. And you know, the way we fish for them is quite social and rewarding as well. So you know, maybe that's it. If the big UK companies are getting over there, then they're probably using our sort of methods with the buzzers and the, you know, screaming reels. And I can see, you know, if it takes off everywhere else, then why wouldn't it in America? You know, they've got everything there for them.
Yeah, there's one fella who's actually a bassist from an old band I used to listen to called Fear Factory. He puts a lot of carp fishing pictures up on his Facebook, and it looks exactly like you'd see pictures from over here or in Europe. Yeah, the rods are out on buzzers, on pods, in nice-looking lakes.
That's good. Maybe we'll end up on a carp fishing holiday in America at some point.
That would be nice. Anyway, it'd be nice. Actually, going out and going fishing would be nice at the minute.
Yeah, I'm super busy. We've got the Northern Angling Show coming up very soon. We're according to our countdown on northernanglingshow.co.uk, we are 32 days away, which is scary.
That's getting very close. I know you've been busy. It's been difficult to pin you down for this for the recordings at times.
Yeah, we're in crunch time now. It's squeaky bum time. Tickets are flying out. We're sort of 90% full on the floor space, but there's just lots of organising to do now. It's a year's work in 2 weeks, really, 3 weeks. So that's what we're on now. And hopefully it's at Event City on the 28th and 29th of March. So come and say hello to us on the Carpcast stand. Mark will be there most of the weekend, and I'll be there a little bit, as well as running about like a headless chicken. Yeah, we may even have some merchandise as well, some Carpcast hoodies and T-shirts, although you won't have even seen the logo yet, but hopefully we'll have them in time. So if you want to give us some feedback in person, it's at Event City in Manchester, which is at the back of the Trafford Centre next to Legoland. It's a great day out. There's tons and tons of speakers. You know, we've got the Big Fish off there, Ali and Dean doing a presentation. Lots from the match fishing world. Course fishing world. Danny Fairbrass is doing a talk. Alan Blair's doing his urban banks. So 28th, 29th of March, you can pay on the door, or northernanglingshow.co.uk if you want to save a bit of money and buy the tickets in advance. And say hello to us.
Yeah, I'll be on the Carpcast stand. Like I say, any feedback, any suggestions, I'm all ears.
So we move on to our news and gossip bit, which is, we call it, It's on the Net, It Must Be True.
It's on the net. It must be true.
What have you seen on the internet this week, Mark?
Quite a few bits and bobs, but what really did stand out was a catch made by a chap called Luke Edwards from one of Rob Hale's venues, The Avenue.
That used to have a 60 in there, didn't it? I think it might have died last year, the big one.
Yeah, I mean, a big two-tone fish called Jonah rings a bell. I could be wrong.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I'm looking here now. Are you ready for these weights for a February haul?
Go on.
36.10, 54, and a 38 to finish off.
Wow, he had them in a day as well, didn't he, I believe?
I believe so, yeah. I've had quite a few messages back and forth from Luke, giving a bit of info on it, because as we had a little chat before this, when we were on about the catch, you know, why has it happened? Why is there so many big fish coming out in this time of year? And one of the things we said was, Rig use becoming more widespread. Zigs are banned on the Avenue.
Oh, are they? I didn't know that.
Yeah, maggots, plastic baits, and zigs are banned, so he's told me.
Fair enough.
And the fish were caught from heavily pre-baited areas.
Oh, wow.
It's the old, you're keeping the bait going in, and it has worked for him.
Is he local then to the lakes? He's been going down there baiting it up?
I believe so, yeah.
Has he been catching a few then? He's obviously been doing a few sessions if he's been down there baiting.
He has, yeah. I'm just looking at it now. This is a quote from him. I've had 6 fish out this January in 7-day sessions and one night to £40 2 ounce.
Wow.
That was January. He's had a year's worth of fish in up to now.
Wow. Any other big ones?
Oh, there was a 52 common out of there as well to someone else. Mm. I don't have any more information on that capture, but when I asked Luke what else is in there for him to go for after he's had the 54, there's another 50 mirror and 2 50 commons.
Wow, it's a decent stock in there. I don't know much about it. It's a lad that I knew used to fish it a few years back, and he did have the big one at like 59 or something, and I don't think he fished it much after that. But yeah, maybe we need a carp cast out in up that neck of the woods. It's some cracking fish and cracking scenery around there as well. It's a nice place to go.
Yeah, you know, I've never caught a Shropshire carp.
I've had a few. Yeah, maybe we'll talk about that on another episode. But yeah, the infamous Colmere.
Yeah, that is definitely a story worth telling one time.
Yeah, we'll do that at some point in the future. Maybe get the banana common, which was the fish from there. Maybe get it on the carp top trumps at some point.
Yeah, I'll need a special fish to beat that one.
Anywhere else been fishing? What, have you seen any other catch reports?
I have. I've seen Bray's Nose down on the linear complex are still throwing a lot of fish up. You know, multiple catches. Well, the top two that I've made notes off here were a pair of 32-pound mirrors to Aedas Samsonas. I think that's how his name's pronounced. And another one to a kid called James Ellis.
Yeah, I'm just laughing because I'm just looking at the show notes that you sent me here, and you toned it down a bit, but I think fishing gets tits off is what you've actually written.
That is what I've written, yeah. I think that pretty much sums it up, yeah. It's fishing, it's tits off.
They did quite a few fish at Moxford Lakes in the winter, and I haven't been down there. I need to. I believe I haven't got any info, but I believe Christchurch has actually done fish now. I've heard rumours of this week. Don't know any details. Sorry, guys, for dropping that, but I know it has done some this week, definitely.
I think I might have seen that on Facebook in passing as well. Is it a woman who posts, who runs it or something? That rings a bell.
Yep. Julie, she's called, runs a cafe up there. I think it's a family that have it. I think her dad actually owns the lakes, and I think he might be abroad somewhere. I'm not sure. She runs it with her husband, and her daughter used to run the cafe, but I don't think they work there anymore.
Yeah, that was like, I've got some... You remember back in the day when it was Petals in there?
Yeah, Petals will definitely make a carp top trumps addition, I think. So that was a cracking fish. I'd love to have had a go for that fish. It died before I got interested in going down there. But what a fish that was, sort of looks-wise. There's quite a few well-known people caught it. I think there's a video of Terry Hearn, isn't there? Did he make a DVD down there?
I don't know. Am I right in thinking he had her off the surface as well?
He hooked it twice in a night. I think he lost it. He lost it, then caught it within 12 hours. And I can't remember which way round, whether the one he landed was off the top or when he lost it was off the top. Because there used to be a big sort of band of weed round the edge. And I think if I remember the story of him playing it, it was, you know, he couldn't get it kind of over the weed. Which would make sense that when he lost it, it was off the top. I'm sure he was floater fishing, like, right until it went dark, and then again at first light in the morning. But anyway, he basically hooked it twice in 8 hours, once off the top, once off the bottom. One he landed, one he didn't. I can't remember which way around it was.
Yeah, that's Terry Ernie. He goes there and he does it.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm sure it was documented, did he? I'm sure he made a video of it. I'm sure I've seen some sort of footage. Might have been on that... was it In Pursuit of the Largest DVD that he did, where it was all his home footage from lots and lots of his history captures. I've got the DVD somewhere. Yeah, I'm sure it's on that, actually, the Petals footage.
Yeah, you'll have to lend me that one. I've not seen it, although I know I have got his second book around here somewhere. I'm pretty sure it's in there as well.
Yeah, this is some great footage. It was really inspirational to watch it. I mean, he's done a pretty bad job with the editing, the actual... they've done it himself, him and Nigel Sharp. They're basically sat in their living room kind of talking. I'm a bit of an audiophile geek. You know, I'm into production and making things sound right. And, like, Terry's coming out of one speaker and Nigel's coming out of both speakers. And it gives me a knot in my stomach while I'm listening to it. I'd have to turn it off.
I think that's OCD.
It's not. You've got sort of decent audio and sound equipment. Most people have got, a nice sort of big widescreen TV these days. It's just really annoying when one voice is coming out of one side and the other voice is coming out of both. He should have got me to do it. Could have done him a cracking job. But the footage on there is unreal. All the sort of history captures you've heard him catch over the years, like, they're on there. And if you don't watch that and want to go fishing straight away, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, man, that's what you watch it for, a bit of raw footage from the bank. I mean, the top class anglers, not editors, so...
Moving on. It's on the net, it must be true.
It's on the net, it must be true.
I'm looking at the show notes again. I think you have to do this one.
Yeah, I'll just say this. Now, this will mean nothing to our international listeners, but who really cares who killed Lucy Beale? Who was a character in EastEnders soap opera over here. Couple of days, all I saw on my Facebook, and I... couldn't care. I think it's worse to that effect I've actually written down.
Yep, you've not quite written that. Once again, the show notes say something along the lines of who gives an F who killed Lucy Beale. if you don't watch EastEnders, as probably most guys don't, I haven't watched any of it, but I couldn't miss it on Facebook. It's great now. Whenever anything's on Facebook, if there's a big deal on the TV, somebody getting killed off or... some big drama, you don't have to actually watch it. Your Facebook newsfeed will tell you everything that's going on in any program you want to see. So I feel like I'm not even missing out by not watching TV.
Yeah, what gets me, whenever there's a UFC event on, it'll be on the Sky Plus, I can't even look at my Facebook or Twitter until I've watched it, otherwise I'll just know the results.
I've gone off watching the UFC for that exact reason, because I used to, obviously it's normally on at like 4 o'clock in the morning our time, so I'd stay up, stay up, watch it till like say, 3:30 till 6 or something. And then sometimes, you know, you've got stuff to do on the Sunday and you can't do that. So I'd record it and then I'd wake up in the morning. First thing I'd do before I get up, you have a scan through your Facebook feed, see what's going on over the weekend, look for all the hangover pictures in the morning. And all the UFC results are up there. And it's just like, there's no point in me even watching it now. And it's actually stopped me watching the UFC because there's no point trying to avoid it now. And unless I actually stay up and watch it live, which is not always practical.
You don't want me to tell you who won a Frank Mir and Bigfoot this weekend, then?
I did actually stay up and watch it this week, but I missed the last fight. That's the one coming this weekend. There was one last weekend, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was one weekend just gone in Brazil, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then there's one this weekend. I think Ronda Rousey's fighting.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, that's it. It's a good card, actually, isn't it, with Frank Mir headlining? Yeah, no, I watched the Brazilian one last time. I think I fell asleep through the last fight.
It's on the net. It must be true.
And this was on the net, and it is true. The Rob Hales and his team have been doing a bit of work on the monument. I've not followed it too close, to be honest, but there is a restocking video of the fish going back in there, and what a stock it is. 80-odd 30s and 440s.
Wow.
And a day ticket.
I imagine there was more 40s in there for some reason. I don't know why.
No, that was on the restocking video. There may be more. I don't know.
Is that not including the fish that are actually already in there?
Yeah, well, I've not followed it, but I believe they've actually drained the lake down.
Ah, right. So, yeah, they're the fish that they've took out and put back in. I get it.
Yeah
so 440s and 80-30s. How big's the lake? Do we know?
Again, I don't know. It's not somewhere I've actually fished or taken much notice of, to be honest.
Like I said, we need a trip up there. I haven't done much day ticket fishing over the years, but getting older now and, you know, travelling to fish 4 nights a week on a syndicate, you know, them days are gone really now. There's a bit more day ticket fishing will come into my type of fishing, I think.
You can certainly do a lot worse than some of Rob Hales' waters. Not too far for you either, is it? Not a million miles? A
couple of hours.
No, still a fair trek.
Yeah, a couple of hours.
It's on the net. It must be true.
So still on the net for the second week is all the talk about the big fish off, which is Ali Hamidi and Dean Macy. They were in the Ebro this time, must have filmed it a lot earlier in the year. The two guests were Julian Lewis-Jones and Kirk Norcross. I thought it was really good. I thought it continued on from the first episode. Lads having fun again. It was nice to see him abroad. It looked like the fishing was tough, to be honest. I actually spoke to Ali today about them coming to the angling show. He was saying how tough it is on some of these shoots. You know, you're under pressure. You've got the celebrities for literally a few days and you have to make it all happen. I think a lot of it was fished early in the year as well. It was filmed early in the year and the fishing was quite tough. They did catch. I don't think they had any carp on the carp bit.
I think there was one carp caught, a little common, if I remember rightly, but it was certainly not what the Ebro can do.
No, and then they had a small cat and then a pretty decent-sized one that Kurt caught. Kurt looks like he's really into his fishing, super keen. I think, Julian's an actor who goes sea fishing, I think, and it looked good, I think. Ali and Dean are turning into real sort of mainstream celebrities. I mean, you know, we're obviously well known in the fishing world, but I think they're coming across really well. And by the end of the series, you know, they're going to be not quite as famous as Robson Green, but not far behind.
Yeah, they certainly get the name out there, and they're showing fishing to be the fun that it is. Quite a lot of, in the big fish off, it seems to be quite a mix between the actual fishing and a bit of, friendly rivalry competition and a lot of banter, a lot of fun.
What I've noticed from the feedback on social media again is even some of the people that were pretty harsh last time, they seem to have softened a bit. I know Des Taylor, good friend, top guy, all-round angler, he was fairly critical of the first episode and he's certainly softened and backtracked, you know, so he thought the second one was great. So I think a lot of people's instant reaction was to put it down, you know, thinking it's, as we said in the last edition, that let's knock Corder if we can. And, you know, Corder have got nothing to do with it. I'm sure they can't be allowed to advertise anything on there. I mean, they were filling the bags with tubs of goo and the labels were off the goo. They never mentioned the name. It's not about advertising product. It's an entertainment program. And I think it hits a nail on the head. It's doing it very well.
Even the sticker was taken off the Delkims. I don't know if you noticed that one.
Didn't notice that one, no. But, yeah, I mean, you know, they're not advertising anything, even products that, you know, they're associated with. It's just a straight-out entertainment program, and I think it's working. And Dean and Ali are doing a fantastic job of being the faces of it, you know, the hosts. And I think that's only going to grow. And I'm looking forward to the next one. The next one's the one that... all the adverts, all the trailers for it, you know, they showed Dappy with his cheeky face. And that's next week. I think it's Ollie Locke from CBB.
And whereabouts are they fishing next week, do you know?
I'm not actually sure. It doesn't say on the post that I'm looking at.
No, I've got the schedule in front of me. It just gives the names.
No, I can see a lake, and I can see Ali holding a small common carp. So it looks like they do catch some fish. I think Ali said to me today, actually, as well, that they do catch quite a few on this one, which, you know, they had struggled for fish on the earlier ones. So maybe it's sort of later in the spring when they film this. But, yeah, that's is it Wednesday night that it shows?
It is Wednesday night, 8 o'clock at ITV4.
Looking forward to it, and like I say, I think the initial knockers have softened a little bit from the stuff that I've been reading, because it's pretty hard to not like it. It's doing fishing good. It's not just a carp-based program. It's, you know, they start off with the small stuff, and there's something for everyone in there, I think. I'd rather watch that than CBB or, you know, Made in Chelsea or whatever the programs are.
Yeah. You know, I was chatting with a friend about it the other day, and what we actually likened it to, although it's obviously nowhere near in the same lead, was Top Gear, because I watch Top Gear, but I have no interest whatsoever in cars. It's for the entertainment.
That's a very good point,
and
actually.
If people who are not interested in fishing are getting entertained by this, then it's job done.
That's an extremely good point. Yeah, I'm the same. You know, I'm not a petrol head or any specific interest in cars. As long as it's big enough to put me fishing gear in and it gets me to the lake, then...
I'm happy with my Skoda.
Yeah, that's all it needs to do. You know, it's a fishing bus and always has been. Hoping to get a new fishing bus this year. It's a transporter van is what I've had my eyes on for a few years now, and they've become extremely sort of the coolest fishing vehicle you could have. There's a few top anglers got them. You know, Ian McMillan and Rob Hughes both got a real tricky kitted out ones, and I'm hoping to get one myself this year. Yeah, as long as the vehicle gets me to fishing, then that's all it needs to do for me. But yeah, it's good. It's, you know, that one in particular is all about the presenters, Jeremy Clarkson and the rest of them. And like I say, you don't have to be massively interested in cars. There's lots of women watch that program as well. And you know, I mean, that is it's a tier one show with script writers and stuff. So, you know, the Big Fish Off is never going to be a comedy program like that is, but it's certainly light entertainment. You don't have to be into fishing. So it's nice to see that, you know, even the initial knockers have softened up, judging by Facebook. And long may it continue. I'm looking forward to the next episode and more.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Something else you may have seen on the net this week, the Urban Banks guys, Alan Blair and photographer Ollie, and the crew, they were up in Manchester doing Urban Manx. I don't think they caught many fish. I think they did have a couple of really pretty mirrors out of a park lake. But some of the pictures that I've seen Ollie's been taking from the sort of centre of Manchester, there's a Nando's in the background on one of them. And I like the fact that it's always been cool to fish the cool lakes, you know, the lakes everybody's heard of, you know, to go and fish for Arthur or Heather the Leather out the Yateley Car Park Lake, or various other name fish from well-known syndicates. But for the masses, quite difficult to actually get to fish those lakes or to have the time and dedication to compete with the, you know, the sort of pro anglers or the sponsored anglers that those lakes attract. They're circuit waters, and it's very difficult to actually compete on a on an even level with, you know, somebody who appears to have more time than you, that has probably got unlimited access to bait. It's, you know, it's tricky for the average guy to go and do that, but even though they would want to go and catch those particular fish, I think what the Urban Banks has done is kind of open people's eyes to the stuff that's around the corner. You know, it's a different sort of challenge, so you might not be fishing for a 40 or 50 pounder, but you're fishing for kind of fish in very urban town centres, city centres. You know, it stopped me ignoring them canals that you've probably driven past on the way to Tesco's like every day. It's made the kind of urban scenery cool. If you remember Callum McInerney, he made a series of YouTube videos last year where they went abroad to Belgium and Holland and fished those sort of lakes. You know, they fished the canals with all the industry at the background, in the background, you know, with all the night shots with you know, just sick lighting. And it reminds me of the Industrial Revolution that we did at school, you know, when the first mills and, you know, the big industry was built in all the mill towns and your Manchesters and, you know, Yorkshire was big, wasn't it? Sheffield had a lot of industry. And like the art of the decade or the art of the era was pictures of these big industry and big buildings. You know, they weren't, you know, a lot of them are run down and they just look like eyesores now. But in the day, they were kind of like cool because it was new. And I think a lot of these fishing pictures that I'm seeing that people like Ollie are doing, I don't know, it's making it look cool. And it's not about trying to catch a 50 pounder, it's trying to catch fish that maybe don't get fished for a great deal, or the fact that you're on a concrete jungle, or, you know, you're in a place that's not nice and green, and, you know, you might be drilling holes and putting screws in for your, you know, for your bivvy to keep it up. But it's made it cool, and the beauty of it is that everybody can do it. Everybody's got a canal, or it's the Keys down in Salford they've been fishing, and the fish aren't particularly big, but it's made them desirable, I think, because it's cool.
Yeah, I'd say it's accessible to everyone, and I'm just looking at the picture on the Urban Banks Facebook page now with the Nando's in the background. I'm not sure I could concentrate on fishing, I'd be in Nando's. With the you know, this urban thing, the it's one thing I never realised back in the time, but there's a local venue to me, it's only about an acre and a half, just a rectangle. But where it is, there's a McDonald's in one corner, an aluminium factory at one bank, about 200 yards and the other way is a bakery. So if the wind was blowing from that direction, you just sat there drooling. Wow. And then on the other side is a big roundabout and a main road. And to me back then, it was just somewhere that I'd carp, and I actually caught my first double 20 and 30 from it.
Has it still got fish in now?
It has, yeah. It's still got fish to low 20s, I believe. The 30 was, it was £32 when I caught it, but it was grossly spawn-bound. It should have been a low 20. It was a bit of a freak.
I think it's great because the picture, the header picture at the top now is from Manchester, from the trip that they've just done. I mean, it just looks sick. It's just a concrete bank with a rod pod on it, and just all the apartment blocks in the background all looking purpley and reflecting in the water. I mean, it's as good as any scenic, picturesque, beautiful lake shot, I think. It's just something cool about it. I know it's only carp fishing. It's, you know, it's not glamorising it. There's, you know, there's no special fishing there. But I think just the fact that it's accessible for everybody, and it makes, you know, not so well-known fish about just as desirable as catching these other special fish. I don't know. I think it's good. And it stops me ignoring, you know, these bits of water, your local park lakes, all the things that we take for granted around us. It's made them kind of cool. You see, everybody, you know, the word urban's used in everything now in relation to fishing. You know, I see it cropping up all over the place. And I'm glad they got up north to come to Manchester. And we spoke about it before. You're saying some good bits near you, Doncaster Way and stuff.
Oh, without a doubt, definitely.
It certainly made me want to go and fish, you know, some of these places. And the 220s that they caught from this park lake, I mean, you know, people that I know that live in Manchester didn't even know about this lake, and these are absolute stunners, like real scaly badman fish, you know, they look beautiful.
Is that a spoiler for the next Urban Banks video you've just let loose?
I think it was more of a recce trip. I don't think I don't think they've got enough footage of fish. I mean, obviously it was freezing cold, it was minus two a couple of nights, and I know they didn't catch out the Keys. I don't think there's actually that many carp in there. There used to be years ago, but I don't think there's a lot now. But just for the scenery alone, Yeah, but they did other stuff. I know they had ITV down filming them because they had the kids down from Get Hooked on Fishing. They were drop shotting for Perch.
Oh, that's good.
They got a bit of coverage on the 6 o'clock news yesterday, Monday, it was, I think. So yeah, I think it's good for fishing, just to make us not ignore all the other bits of water, as well as the syndicates and the obvious places. There's a few more places that you never quite know what's in there.
Yeah, and the canal systems up and down the country are pretty much untapped. A lot of them. You get out off the beaten track, but also imagine what's in some of the reservoirs that just never get carp fished. Any bit of water can hold fish, carp.
I'm friends with an extremely underground pike angler who's, caught more 30s and 40s than most of the pike names that you've ever heard of. He's not a publicity guy. He's not interested in any of that, but he catches a lot. But he's telling me, like, a lot of the reservoir he knows that have got potential record piking and stuff, a lot of them are trout reservoirs and you just can't fish them. And occasionally they'll get a week where they're allowed to get on there. They'll be booking these a year or two in advance sometimes to try and get on these special places. And I always say to him, have you seen carp in any of these? And he said to me, you tell me where you see the big pike on your carp travels and I'll tell you where I find the carp.
Like a fair trade.
Quite often they're out in the boats and stuff, on these reservoirs. And he says there are some very big carp in some of them. Okay, so we move on to the next section, which is interesting things that we've found in our Worth a Look section.
Worth a Look.
And what is Worth a Look at the minute? Pop into your local tackle shop. Corder Masterclass 2 is the free DVD that they've just released. And working in a tackle shop, I thought it was rude not to take one home and have a look. It's good, as you'd expect from Corder. Well, very professionally shot. And there's only four different sections on this one. And we've just been talking about Urban. The first bit is the Urban Day session. Tom Dove on Walthamstow Reservoir, showing how he approaches them. Secondly is Big Hit Fishing, which is Ali Hamidi and Neil Spooner. They are on one of the linear fisheries, and, they do exactly what they say. They big it and show you exactly how to do it. Then we have third section, the Italian job. Danny and Ali are in Italy, fishing quite a snaggy, intimate mountain lake. I'll be honest, for someone like me who's not catfished abroad, I did quite enjoy it. But what's really, for me, the cream of this is the low-stock big picks, which is Danny and Daryl, though mainly Daryl, fishing quite a low-stock 100-acre Belgian pit. I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but some of the fish on there are amazing. Well worth a watch. And obviously there's all the Corder products mentioned. It is their free DVD, obviously, but it is really, really worth a look. You will learn.
It's good for fishing, I think, when they... It was, I think Nash did the first free one after the success of the Corder Underwater DVDs. Then Nash, I remember them filming it all. I think I might have been on the first one. They made basically just a free DVD that was kind of entertainment and, tips and tricks, as well as featuring the products. And I know Nash did it instead of doing... They used to do a big catalogue, and they worked out the money it cost them to print this catalogue. They could make a DVD for the same money and put them free in all the shops. And, for the angler, for the actual person, it was great. Much rather be entertained watching a programme, learning a few bits while seeing, the equipment at the same time, than, flicking through a catalogue that gets put in the corner. And everybody's done it since, a lot of the big companies now, and they're really good. These companies put a lot of time into them, and I'm going to check out the Corder one. I've not seen it yet.
Yeah, it's not just carp companies either. Quite a few free DVDs as it make the way into the shop, and then onto YouTube as well.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, the internet is changing how we look at stuff these days. The free content for everything, from fishing to all sorts of stuff. YouTube kind of started it. There's all streaming channels now. Poker's really big on Twitch streaming, which was actually gamers. Gamers used to stream themselves playing live, and then all the poker players are doing it now. And I'm sure we'll maybe get some live carp streaming at some point.
I think that might have already happened.
Really?
Yeah, I'd have to look, and I will do for the next Carpcast. But I'm sure I've seen, was it a European thing, they actually had cameras live in a swim.
Ah.
Underwater.
Yeah, well, all the services are out there.
I'll have to dig that up.
There's loads of streaming services, Ustream and stuff, and obviously that Twitch is gone really big amongst gamers and poker players now. But, yeah, it's a matter of time. I mean, the thing is with TV is they have to condense stuff and edit stuff and be politically correct and edit all down to a half an hour, 1 hour programme. We've got unlimited internet these days. You know, going back to the poker, which maybe similar to carp fishing, it's very difficult to tell the full story in half an hour, you know, to tell actually what happens, because there's a load of things all built up to that point that might have took 8 hours, or in carp fishing, you know, 48 hours, you know, a couple of days on the bank. And if there comes a way to actually, you know, project that where you can just tune in live, imagine if you could follow Daryl Peck's entire session, you knew he was going on to Yateley for 3 nights, you know, and you could just log in at any point and watch how the session's going. And you know, it's maybe a long way in the future, that sort of thing, but it's certainly possible. You know, a couple of webcams mounted in the trees pointing down at his rods, one out to the lake, and you can see what he sees when he looks out onto the water, see if there's any fish showing. Or, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility in the future. That would be worth a look.
Worth a look.
Yeah, definitely. I think that'd be one of those things. Either people would look for a few minutes, think that was boring, switch it off, or you would be hooked and never get any work done.
Yeah, well, that's what
probably
happens.
The latter.
it obviously depends who it is, and, you know, and where they're fishing. But you know, I think I'd be watching the water, thinking maybe I'll see one that he doesn't see. You know, oh, there's bubbling. Yeah. There's bubbling over there. You know, and then obviously a lot of these live streaming things, they have chat in there, so you can just type into the chat box, "Hey, Daryl, have you seen, you know, that bubbler on the right hand side of the screen?" He might be cooking his dinner. He might have missed it.
Yeah, I know. When I've been there, my intention has been focus on the water, watch the water. As soon as I look away, you hear that flap, flap, boosh as something nuts out. And
yeah, just wind
I've
it,
done that countless wind, times.
Wind it back a minute on the screen. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I'm sure at some point in the future, I know my laptop battery, you could probably do it with a couple of webcams off that, but it lasts about 7 hours battery on mine. So, I mean, it's not going to cover a session, but who knows, live streaming from the bank, big leisure battery probably last a couple of days on a laptop. Who knows what's in the future, but certainly in the future it is changing. I mean, look at those drones, you know, you've seen the little sort of radio-controlled quadcopters that have been around for a little while. They have GoPros on them, or people have fitted GoPros on them. They're not great in the wind, but I mean, you imagine kind of on a hot summer's day and the lake's flat, and kind of instead of walking round to every corner, climbing up the trees and you know, trying to spot those fish, you just sit there with an iPad screen, set the thing up and fly it, you know, go and check all the corners of the lake from the car park, and you know, you see, oh, there's a big shoal of black fish there, you know, you see the black shapes in, under that tree. And bang, that's, you know, I'm sure there's carp anglers that have already got them, because it's occurred to me, and you know, that they do live stream down to an iPad. So why wouldn't you just fly them across the lake? You know, the trouble is obviously when it's very carpy or windy, then they're not too great in the wind, but certainly on those summer's days, for just zapping it across a bay and just seeing. But then, I mean, how different is that to a bait boat with an echo sounder, you know, which is kind of frowned upon amongst the hardcore anglers. I suppose the difference with a drone is that you're not actually putting anything in the water. You know, you could do it over somebody else's peg, you know, rather than go and send a bait boat through someone else's swim to have a look around. But I mean, you can buy bait boats with cameras mounted on them now, you know, a camera out the front and a camera pointing down into the water. If you look, I know the hardcore people, you know, will never get around using, you know, a centre pin reel and a cane rod and flicking bits of bread out, but technology is moving on, and obviously there was a whole section of the carp community that look down on bait boat captures. Can you imagine when we're, you know, dropping boilies out of a quadcopter and while we're videoing the water? Who knows what's in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all one for taking advantage of whatever technologies are available, but I'm also a great believer in watercraft and learning the craft. And whereas I'll never knock bait boats, I still don't give credit, as much credit to a bait boat capture as to a non-bait boat capture, just because anyone can turn up at a lake, put whatever in the bait boat, steer it out and press a button to drop it. That takes out everything of casting out, feeling your lead down, feeling what it lands on. Do I want to fish on that? Do I not? Trying it again.
I mean, do we like things because they're harder to do? You know, like when we were younger and, you know, there wasn't even rod bags that you could keep your rods made up in. That made it easier to tackle up every session when you go fishing. You know, you got your rigs and everything. It's literally threading a bait on and casting it out. So, I mean, that got easier. But some people seem to, they have this snobbery that, you know, the harder it is to do, the better it is. Or, I mean, it's certainly more rewarding if you've worked for something. I don't know. I mean, back in your Chris Yates days and stuff, when they did have centerpin reels and cane rods and stuff, and like they were not having a Century NG casting 160 yards with a 5 ounce lead. You know, it was impossible to do given the technology at that time. So if they were on a big lake and they saw all these big fish boshing out in the middle, they were like, look, it's impossible to catch them. You know, it's not looked down upon that our equipment got better and we can now bang a lead out that far to catch these fish. So I mean, like, where do you draw the line? You know, I know that I can cast a decent distance, present a bait properly and catch fish at range, but so I've nothing to prove to myself. Why shouldn't I send a boat out that same 150 yards and make everything presented nice? I mean, it depends why you go fishing. If you just go in for entertainment, for an enjoyable hobby, to pass the time, get a bend in the rod, maybe catch a big fish, maybe catch your target fish, that's the enjoyment part of it. I mean, how hard do you want to make it? Why don't we all go back to cane rods and split cane rods and centre pins if you're really that hardcore? You know,
well, they are carpy.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we used to watch the tip or use a butt indicator. We now have alarms. You know, nobody seems to think that's a problem having, but that's because there was primitive alarms back in the day. But even going back to the days of putting stones or coins on top of your reel and biscuit tin underneath, you know, to make the rattle. I mean, they were kind of like the first alarms. You know, I did that when I was a kid. We'd find all sorts of ingenious ways to try and wake ourselves up at night and stuff if we had a bite. You know, where do you want to draw this line of making things easy for yourself? Are we supposed to stay up for 24 hours and just watch the rod tip going? Or, you know, it's totally acceptable to have a bite alarm with an indicator and you can be in your tent with the door down. I mean, where's the watercraft going on there?
This is where, with the bait belts and any technology, really, it's all down to what the individual wants out of his fishing, because there's no hard, fast rules or guidelines. It's what each individual wants out of his fishing.
What about when you're on the lake doing it the hardcore way, though, and the guy in the next room's blasting the bait belt out and catching all the fish? You know, then people get bitter. They're like, oh, well, it's don't count. You know, he's caught it on a bait belt, and it's like, well, you can use one if you want. You know, it's like, oh, no, I want to catch them the proper way. And like, what is the proper way? Is the proper, you know, are we going to go back to split cane rods and centre pin reels and potatoes? Is that the only way to catch a carp? And is everything since then cheating?
I'm going to lose this debate, aren't I?
Well, I'm not saying that's my opinion. I'm playing devil's advocate and just saying, you know.
But you have used a bait belt, I know that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think they're great.
That's a sign of age.
But I also know, you know, if I'm fishing a lake where you can't use a bait belt, I know I can cast as well as the top casters. I'm not talking about extreme distance, but I'm talking about being able to present a bait effectively with free bait around it. You know, I can, I'm not saying, you know, it's not like a pissing contest as to who can cast the furthest, because there's people out there that can cast 200 plus yards. But I'm saying for an average lake, I can fish effectively as far as the next guy. I can put a marker float there, I can find a spot, I can put a rig there, and I can put bait around it at a reasonable distance. I know I can do it. I don't have anything to prove to anybody, and if I have to do it, I do. But if you're allowed to use a bait belt on that particular lake and you can make life easier, why wouldn't you? You know, I'm not competing against the next guy now. You know, I'm doing it because I want to enjoy my trip. And when in Rome, you know, I'm not going to take a bait belt to a lake nobody uses a bait belt. But, you know, if everyone else is using one, I'm going to use one. It's that simple.
Yeah, I can't really argue with that. Although things, as you know, in fishing, always go around on a full circle. It reminds me of a situation a couple of friends on the Moltway Pond found themselves in a few years back, which was a lake. It's a snaggy pit. It was dominated by bait boats. And they started catching quite a lot of fish by leaving the bait boats at home and just spreading the bait far and wide in the swim.
The key is to catch the fish, right? That's why we go fishing.
Yeah.
We want to catch them. And by any fair way possible that doesn't put the fish in danger, you know, so they're still there for other people to get the same enjoyment that we've just had. So, like, that's kind of where my morals lie on it. If I'm fishing a circuit lake and it's a real big deal to catch the certain fish, then, you know, I'm going to pit my wits against, you know, I'm naturally competitive, so I'm going to pit my wits against the next angler. If everyone's fishing it pretty hardcore, you know, I'll fish it the same way. Apart from that kind of situation where you are all after the same kind of prize, you know, there might be half a dozen regular anglers that are there week in, week out, all trying to catch, you know, one particular fish. Then, you know, you are competing whether you like it or not, because that fish might only get caught once or twice that year, and, you know, there's only one or two people going to be lucky enough to, you know, have the pictures on the camera. But, you know, if I'm going to, if I'm just going fishing because this is my monthly fishing trip, I want to get out for a few days, I wouldn't mind having a social with my pal, I want to catch a few fish, you know, I'm going to do that. I'm not going to make that session as hard as I possibly can, you know. It's like, you know, should we leave the bivvy at home then and just like hardcore it under the stars, and, you know, let's not take any, you know, let's not take all our cookers and everything that's go down to, you know, some. You can make it as hard as you want, or you can make it as easy as you want.
Yeah, I'm still taking my comforts. I'm not kipping under the stars or going hungry.
This is my point. Like, it's got easier to fish as technology's got better. You know, sleeping bags have got warmer. You know, my feet don't stick out the end of a brolly like they used to with a bin bag over it for when it rains, because brollies weren't big enough, you know, when I was a kid.
Oh, mine stuck out from the knees.
No, we had a 45 inch tilt brolly, you know, and you were lay on the floor on a rod bag with your feet sticking out the end with a bin bag over it, you know, and it was uncomfortable, and every night seemed like an extremely long time. So,
yeah, like, one of the few of us used to fish together. Did you have one of the old blue Argos ratchet sun loungers to sleep on?
I had the flowery one because they didn't have any blue or red ones.
I was going to say, there were a few of us used to fish together, all with the blue ones, and a friend went and bought one, arrived to the lake with it in his cardboard box, opened it, and he's got the floral pattern on it, and, oh, we didn't take the piss out of him too much.
I had the fluoro one. There was three. There was a red one, a blue one, and a flowery one. When I went to buy mine, I got the flowery one, that was all he had, and I had to have it. Like, I got one a few years later on a fish horseshoe, probably like 1988, I reckon, pre-carp society, pre them owning it, and I bought this. It was like kind of like those ratchet ones, and it was flowery, but it had like a really thick mattress on it, and oh, it was heaven. It didn't fold up quite as good as the red and blue ones. But it was just comfort.
Yeah, I know mine folded up well, usually while I was laid on them.
The equipment's got so much better. This is my point. So, like, at what point do you stop? I'm guessing if you're a purist, then it's rod and line. You know, you cast with a rod and you pull the fish in via line. I mean, I'm down with that. But then, you know, I remember Terry Hearn on Yateley Car Park Lake doing his three rod trick that he talks about in his first book, where he's not casting in. You know, he's trying to get that line into a corner of the lake, so he's flicked the lead over onto the bank, and then he's got another rod on the bank that he lowers the rig in with, you know, from the far side. I mean, technically, you might as well just use a bait bowl, because you're still, you know, you haven't cast that from your peg, because it was virtually impossible to do. So, I mean, Or the same, if you can find a spot down the margin that you can place by hand. I mean, you've still not cast with rod and line, so what's the difference in just sending a bait boat down? I can understand, you know, total purists, and I would get down with, you know, the philosophy of, if it's not rod and line, it doesn't count. I can see that point. This is not meant to be a bait boat debate. It's a more general debate about using technology to our advantage. You know, it's like going back to the point I've said about four times, you know, we didn't have tackle that could cast 100 yards not too many years ago, and, you know, people are now making more advanced lines using more advanced materials, you know, all that are stronger at thinner diameters, and technology's moving forward. So
yeah. Do you think there's a point where it will go too far and make it too easy?
Yeah, when you've got a drone with a camera on it, and you tie a bag of bait to the bottom of it, put your rig in, you send it out across the lake until you see some fish on your iPad screen. Yeah, obviously there is, But I mean, by the same token, I don't want to be that guy that's like, oh, it was much harder when we were kids and the fish now don't count, you know, because things do move on. Our life's got easier. You know, we've got super comfy bed chairs now in bivvies that don't leak, that have ground sheets, you know, and it's really comfortable to stay on the bank for a week now in any conditions. It's extremely comfortable. And that wasn't, you know, 15, 20 years ago, so.
No, the biggest problem I've got with my bed chair now is actually getting off it.
I think if I had to make an argument for, you know, keeping it kind of like hunting, you know, like pitting us against the fish, then it's, you know, the rod and line argument, then yeah. But then, you know, like this rod and line argument, where does a catapult fit into that? You know, it's a machine that gets bait from the bank to the spot. Like, but nobody would bat an eyelid about not using the catapult. Let's say you cast your rod, but you did your baiting up with a bait boat.
Well, I think the baiting scenario was going to be a lot different. You get your bait boat a damn sight further than you can with any catapult.
Well, yeah, but, you know, let's say somebody made a catapult that's super elastic that goes twice as far, you know, or let's say you're only fishing 40 yards out in catapult range. Why shouldn't you use a bait boat to just drop that bait? It's still a tool that you're using to get that bait out. You're not casting it out or throwing it by hand. This is what I'm saying. I mean, you know, I'm being argumentative, but
yeah,
the point is there is technology out there that makes life easy. So why do we think that it's more of an achievement if we make things harder for ourselves? You know, then people used to hunt fish with spears back in the day, you know, because they had to eat. You know, that's catch them to live. Do you think they'd use a bait bow? Somebody says, yeah, you catch them 10 times easier there.
Well, they'd use a bow and arrow.
Yeah, but they're going to use the thing that makes them get them off out the water in the easiest possible way. If you have to do it to survive, to eat. Anyway, shall we move on to carp top trumps?
Carp top trumps.
Yeah, and I think we've got a bit of an issue to solve from last time.
Yes, there has been a steward's inquiry, which is probably not good news for Yorkshire.
Oh, I don't know. I think it's my personal opinion anyway. I'm sure you'll disagree. I think the result should stand.
I'm sure you do. Basically, what we're talking about is the halfling from Dead Man's, which was the Lancashire fish, because we had the War of the Roses. I said it had only been... I should have done more research. Bear in mind, I caught the fish, or hooked it three times, landed it twice. It came out loads over 40, with a personal best weight of 44 ounces, which is actually bigger than the Motway fish, and we scored it lower on the... There was only a point between the two fish, and we scored it 1 point less than the Motway fish because of the size. The size was incorrect. The size is actually bigger, which means it should have been at least even for the tie or a point ahead, really, which means you'll be 0-2.
No, I think we should go for a draw or a no contest.
like I say, it has already happened, but I certainly didn't lose. Yeah, let's not go back over it, but you still haven't won one yet. So let's see if you can change it today.
You have to get that in. Yes, I think we will.
What two fish have we got today?
Two fish. We're going down to Bedfordshire. Two fish that we both know well. We've both had in the net and held up and photographed. The twin from Elstow 2. And just up the road, Starburst from the club Lake Willington.
Sadly, now deceased. Both fish.
Yes.
They've all been dead, haven't they, to the fish that we've done? What did we put the lady against in week one?
That was against Arthur. Is Arthur still around, or is that one gone as well? The car park.
I think Arthur might have gone last year, which means we haven't done a fish that's living yet.
No, we'll have to do a living fish next week.
Okay. Yeah, well, let's pick something that's alive. So, yes, the twin we both caught from Elstow. Elstow 2, back in the hardcore days on Elstow 2, when it had 17 carp in there, I think. Up the road, Willington, which was a cracking club lake, that had one fish in there called the Starburst Mirror, because it had some nice Starburst scales on the side. And I was fortunate enough to catch that. So, as usual, we do the five categories, which are weight, looks, merit of capture, difficulty of capture, and how the fish fights. So we score each section out of 10, one being the lowest, 10 being the highest. And it's just like the top trumps you had when you were a kid. We work out each fish's score, total them up, and see who beats the other one. So which one are you taking? You're taking the twin, I guess.
I am. That was the bane of my life for about 2.5 years till I finally caught it, so I think it's only right.
Okay, what was its best ever weight?
Its best ever weight was 47 plus to John Knight.
I remember, yeah. Did he not catch it a number of times that
Four
year?
Times.
In one season? And it,
yeah.
He had the lake reasonably to himself, and I know he was putting a hell of a lot of bait in.
He's putting a sick amount of bait in from what I'm told, and he got the rewards for it.
Yeah, he actually told me a few years later when we met him on St. Ives, she told me that he was actually only putting 10 kilos a week in, but the stories at the time were like 30 kilos a week, but he was saying he was just putting 10 kilos of the same bait in, you know, including what he was using for his session, and that he had all the fish trained. Like, every, you know, the twin was like his pet. He just kept catching it, didn't he?
Yeah, he even had it from deep water as well, you know, 30 plus foot, which the twin wasn't known for.
No, it just shows the, you know, the effect of pre-baiting. If you're the only one using that bait, and, you know, if it's not a particularly busy lake, you just get the fish totally trained. And in a lake that size, 35-ish acres, to know that 10 kilos spread around the lake is enough, because that's not a lot spread around a 30-acre lake.
With the nature of Elstow 2, as you know, a lot of the location wasn't about finding the fish, it was eliminating areas where they wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Which could narrow it down to the likely spots.
Yeah, definite. So 47 pound, that's a pretty impressive weight, especially for the time.
And what was the top weight of the Willington fish?
The Willington fish is, because it was a club lake, there was quite a lot of information and disinformation, but it hit 40, high 48, maybe even 49 pound. It was rumored to have come 49, and no one could actually, it was always a friend of a friend, nobody could actually speak to the guy that caught it. But the year I caught it, I had it at 46.10, and it had definitely been bigger that year. I caught it in the autumn, and I know in the spring I think it had been high 48s.
Yeah, I had a deer with a 48 capture of it. So I'm one round down already.
What are we going to give? 47. That's got to be an 8, I would say, for the twin. And so we're going to have to go 9 for Starburst.
I think we are.
With it just pipping it. Okay, and the looks of the fish.
I think the twin, with those great big plates along both shoulders, was an absolutely stonking fish. I mean, I remember the first time I ever saw that fish was on the front cover of Carp Talk. Didn't know where it lived back then, but I remember looking at it just thinking, one day I want to catch a fish like that. Not knowing I wanted to catch that one, but...
Yeah, it wasn't a particularly fat belly. It was just a classic kind of shaped carp. Was it a dink strain fish?
I believe it was, yeah. I mean, the story goes that the twin and several others were actually purchased by the local anglers from a nearby garden centre and put in really small.
Yeah, I did hear that. They went in, like, really small, didn't they? Like, 2 or 3 pound or something?
Yeah, so I believe.
And, it was a cracking fish. I mean, if anyone has not seen the fish, have a look at it. There was another fish that looked very similar, wasn't it? The Epilepse, was it?
Epilepse, yeah. Hence the twin in its name, the twin.
Ah, yeah. And they had really distinctive big plates across the top of the back. I remember when I caught it, you were with me. I'd already caught the mother that year, and, you know, obviously really wanted to catch the twin, as everybody did on that lake, but I didn't want to believe it was the twin. You netted it, didn't you? And you said, I think it's the one, and I was like, it's Epilepse, it must be Epilepse. And you're like, no, it's the twin. I was like, no, it must be Epilepse. And you're like,
yeah,
no.
I remember that. I mean, as soon as I looked down, as soon as I put the head torch on and saw those scales on the shoulders, I'd looked at the pictures of that fish so many times, I knew exactly what it was instantly.
Yeah, it was a cracking night. Like, you caught a PB that night, and we'd had a few beers, hadn't we? You had two fish, actually, didn't you? And then
I had one called The Import, which actually equaled my PB at the time, which was 32.12. And then later on in the early hours, I had a fish called Little Shoulders at 28. That was three fish out in one night for a pit that Yeah. Like you say, I had 17 fish in it total.
It hadn't done a fish for about 2 months either, had it? Because we'd been there every week. We were waiting for the weather to change at the back of summer. It had been really high pressure on a deep lake. And nobody had caught anything for a good couple of months. And we had the first bit of low pressure and cloud and wind. And then we blanked for a couple of days. I was there a day before you. And, you know, we were on the end of the wind. And it got to the point where I thought, they're not on the wind. You know, they can't be. It's too cold. We've messed up, you know, they're not here. And then all in the space of a night, well, in one night, you had obviously that first one sort of tea time-ish, wasn't it, 4 or 5 o'clock in there?
It was the evening, yeah.
And then we were celebrating that with a few beers in my peg, and I thought you'd kicked the rod when it beeped. I remember saying to you, was that you? Because you were sat on me unhooking, Matt, with your right leg kind of up, touching the bank stick.
Yeah, it was a tight swim, that one.
Yeah, and you know, I was like, is that you? And you went, not me. I stood by the rod, and then, you know, it tightened up three or four bleeps, because it was only a rod length out. I never imagined I would have got a bite there, bearing in mind we were sitting having a couple of Stellas.
Yeah, I don't think we were being too quiet either, if we're honest.
No. And then obviously it went, and then we got really drunk after that. then all I remember is you shaking me in the middle of the night saying, I've got one. I'm like, yeah, and rolled over, went back to sleep. And then in the middle of my dream, like, you came into my dream, like, you'd got a fish on. And then, I went into your peg and you had the other one. So, yeah, it was one of those extremely memorable nights. I have to say, it was an absolutely stonking looking carp. You know, it's definitely right up there. It's certainly worth an 8, I think.
Yeah, I've got to agree with an 8. Whereas the Starburst fish, it was a nice looking fish, but it wasn't anything special, to be honest.
No, it was looks-wise. Big Italian, sort of deep bellied fish. It did have that little cluster of starburst scales on one side, but it makes it sound really pretty. Whereas it was actually quite bland, wasn't it? I would say it's just a big chunk of a fish, and you know, fish I really wanted to catch, but it certainly wasn't a looker the same as the twin. I'd probably go for a 6 if the twin.
I was going to say 6 as well.
Yeah, merit of catcher. The twin's up there, isn't it? I think
the twin is up there. Yes,
it came out. It would come out 4 times a year. I know John Knight had it a few times that one year. But, I mean, generally it was 3 to 4 times a year. I mean, I suppose this is more difficulty. The actual merit of catcher is more the desirability of it. You know, is it a notch on your bedpost once you've caught it, sort of thing?
Yeah, and I still think the twin is up there, mainly because it was better known than the Starburst fish. We being a relatively cheap club lake, it was kept hush-hush for quite a long time by the locals.
Yeah, it was definitely, and especially whenever it did a big capture, you know, because it was when we first started fishing Elstow, it was a scraper 40, and we were fishing for 2 41s, 42s, which were really significantly large fish at the time. You know, that there would be the equivalent of a 54 pound fish now, I would say, if you were to.
I've got to agree that definitely, and
if you're to equate the difference, you know, there weren't that many fish bigger. You know, obviously there was a few notable ones, your Conningbrook fishes and stuff, but you know, the 50s we target today with the low 40s of then. We were talking what, 12 years ago, 11 years ago, or something.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel really old now. Yeah, it was 2001 I first fished there.
Was that 14 years ago? Wow, that is a long time ago.
Yeah, so 2002 when I first met you on there. That's when you it was your first season. You had the boat, didn't you?
Yeah, stuffy.
Yeah, it's 2002.
Wow, yeah, 13 years ago. So yeah, it was February 2002. I did my first ever session. Actually, the mother and the twin had both been out the week before my first session in February.
I remember that, both 43s.
Yeah, so I mean, at the time, the twin was, you know, one of the top fish in the country, I would say, for merit of capture. A ticket that you could actually go and get that was accessible. There weren't many bigger fish in the country that you could just go and fish for.
Yeah, I remember there was no waiting list either. In fact, the Pit 2 ticket was the waiting list for Pit 1.
Yeah, exactly. And most people bought the ticket and never fished it because they were waiting for a pit one ticket, which had, you know, like the time probably 8:40s in and
40s, 50s, 30s.
Yeah, definitely. So we're going to go for an 8 as far as merit for the twin.
And with that, yeah. What about the Starburst?
I would say that's significantly lower just because, you know, there's a lot of people that would just fly over from Elstow over to Overlake and catch it on the first session sometimes. So it definitely wasn't in the same league. It was later on when it got bigger, but I mean, at the time when I first heard of it, you know, I wasn't really interested in fishing for it compared to the twin and the mother. So, I mean, it's probably going to have to go for a 6, I would say.
Yeah, I'll be there. But we both know Martin Wassell, or Split Shot as he was known back then.
Yeah, he was the one that first put me onto it.
Yeah, over the first time I met him down pit 2, going like an house on fire, he was a lovely fella. The very next morning, he caught the twin at £42. That is the first time I'd ever seen a £40 on the bank. Then what he did, he packed up and hit down Willington and caught Starburst the same week.
So I'm guessing as far as difficulty goes, Starburst can't be a 10. I mean, it took me
now.
I had a few little goes at it at that fish when I decided I really wanted to catch it. But it wasn't until I like decided, right, I'm fishing there, I'm starting this year, and I'm not going to pull off the lake until I've caught it. And that was when I actually caught the fish. So, I mean, it probably took me about 20 nights in total to actually catch it, which is quite short for some target fish. So it's definitely not a 10 as far as difficulty goes. I would probably go for another 5 or 6, somewhere around there.
Yeah,
I would say
the difficulty for Starburst, I think I'd give it a 5. It could do double figures a year. I did 12 nights on the lake. It was my first bite and only bite off a carp anyway, and then it was in my net.
Yeah.
Which, given the nature of the lake, because it was a club lake, any idiot could get a ticket, and quite a few idiots did. It was quite pleasing to catch the fish, so I didn't have to go back there.
I enjoyed my time on there. There was a few decent people on there. What about the twin for difficulty then?
Was different. That took me 2.5 years to hold up for the camera.
Yep, there's not many people caught it straight away. I think that the lake in general was hard. You know, you were against the elements all the time. You know, the walking around with lead boots on from the clay. It was tricky when it was wet. There's brambles everywhere. It's physically demanding to fish.
Very.
You know, just from the pegs. You know, nothing was ready made. It was a tough lake to fish. Even getting your gear down the steep banks and. And then the fish itself, you know, yes, it did come out 4 times a year.
You had to earn it. You know, you didn't get away with bait boats on there. You had to earn it.
Yeah, definitely. So what are we going to give it for difficulty? A 9?
I think I'm going to go with an 8, just because I think the mother would have been a 9 if we were doing it with a mother. Because remember, you used to say, if you caught the mother, you'd stay on for the twin. But if you caught the twin, a lot of people didn't stay for the mother because she was even harder.
Yeah, you're right. It's the mother, you know. It was once every 2 years sometimes.
Yeah. Didn't it go missing for like 4 years before Roger Bacon nailed her?
Yeah, I think you're right. So, okay, we'll give it an 8. And the fight, we both caught the twin.
And this is where we're going to differ. Because I remember you hooking the twin and saying, ah, it's just a tench.
Oh, I did, and then it went on a 40-yard run. And I said, well, maybe it's not. It didn't give me a massive fight, but it did. It did give a decent run, and the reel was spinning, and you said, oh, yeah, that's no tench. But I just kind of didn't want to believe it was a carp, because it was so rare to actually catch a carp from that lake, that it was like it was a bit of disbelief as well that I was actually attached to a carp, because we'd been 2 months without a bite.
We've been a proper pair of blankers.
Yep. But, you know, it did give an account of... What peg did you catch it from?
It wasn't really a peg. Remember the snag swim?
Yeah.
It was halfway between the actual snag swim and the snag's bank.
Was it out the margin in that sort of bit you can see just over the edge?
Yeah.
There's a few pads there and stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly the spot. And it was probably a rod length and a half out, still in about 10 or 12 foot of water.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I hooked it. And it did exactly the same thing to me when there's a take. It was just bleeps, the bobbins dancing around, even though it's that close in. I picked the rod up, struck into it, and it was just like bang, 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 like it's just some massive tench. And then it realised what was happening. It hit the surface, and that was it. It was halfway across to the far bank.
Wow.
It's like, not light, but not dark. It's kind of like twilight. I've got the factory lights opposite me. There's no wind, and I've just got this massive bow wave that I'm attached to and can do absolutely nothing about. Until, because the mother was known with the big paddles as being an absolute battler, until I actually got it in the net and looked down, I thought I was attached to the mother.
Wow.
It went absolutely mental.
So you're going to score it quite high. I mean, I would probably give it a 7. I'm saying you're going for a 9, so let's make it an 8.
I think we should meet in the middle, yeah.
Yeah, we'll give it an 8. Starburst.
We had two different fights with this fish as well.
Yeah, mine, the lake was very, very weedy, like extremely weedy. You were fishing very small holes in super thick weed, and it was kind of an epic. It wasn't not an epic battle that the fish was scrapping, but it was epic. In fact, in relation to time, because I hooked it, and it was Daryl Peck actually that put me onto the slack line technique. Whenever you get a fish weeded up, slacken the line off and leave it for as long as it takes, and it'll always run, which helps pull the lead off as well. And you know, you never pull to the point where you think it might come off, always just slacken the line off. So I've had the take, it's lock solid, which I fully expected, and I couldn't move it at all. So rather than pull it too hard, I put the rod down, slacken the line. You have to have the line hanging off the rod tip with the bail arm open, because you need to, the point of it is you need to let the weed stand up again, because you're pulling the fish into the weed, it compresses the weed. So you know, you let the line kind of go back to normal as the weed stands itself up again. Once the fish, as long as the line's slack, the fish thinks it's free, and it swims off. You get another take. It normally happens fairly quickly the first time, and it takes a bit longer each time if it gets weeded up again. So I've done this, it moved off really quickly. And it must have, when it on the take, it must have charged through the middle of a weed bed, because this happened half a dozen times, and it got longer. I hooked it about 10 o'clock at night, and the first time took maybe a couple of minutes, and it ripped off again, pulled it, and it kept coming back to the same bank of weed that I just couldn't move it through. And I knew it was that fish because it was so heavy, you know, and just couldn't get it through this weed. If it was anything smaller, you know, I knew there was only two. There was only one fish that size. There was another fish that was a 30, and everything else was smaller, you know, 20s. So, or what we thought. I later found out it was a 40-pound common in there. But I just couldn't move it through this weed. And, you know, the third or fourth time of slacking the line off, it took like half an hour, 40 minutes before it moves off again. And all of a sudden, you get a screamer and it's away again. And I kept pulling it back to this same bank of weed. About the fourth or fifth time, it didn't bleep again. And I thought, oh, it's come off. And, you know, I sat there, and it's now gone midnight. And I was thinking, that's it, the fish is gone. I picked the rod up and see if I could feel a kick or anything, and, you know, pulled a bit harder this time, to the point where it may have come off. And couldn't feel anything, so I've put the rod down, you know, put the bait runner back on, put it on the alarm, and sat and waited for it to move. It didn't move. I fell asleep. I'd set the alarm for 5 a.m. You know, just anyway to make sure I was up. Woke up at 5 o'clock. It's thick fog everywhere. I can't see anything, and it's still sort of dark. Wait till it's got light. Pick the rod up, and I've been able to move this weed bed. Like, it's this massive bank of weed, and I'm talking massive, like size of 3 bivvies maybe, top to bottom. and it started moving very, very slowly. No idea if there's any fish on or anything. Anyway, it's took me maybe an hour. It's moving so slowly, but I knew it was moving like millimetres at a time. It took me an hour to move it. I was only fishing 50, 60 yards out. I've got it to like, got its weed bed to the sort of marginal shelf, maybe 10 yards out. And as I've got it to the edge, there's been an absolute eruption on the back of the weed bed, which was the fish. It was still on and moving with the weed bed. It's woke up and, you know, bear in mind, it's been on for 8 hours now, probably.
Oh, that's a long time.
And it ran again, and it ran about 15 yards and locked up again. I couldn't get this weed bed over the actual marginal shelf weed, and there was a guy further down the next peg, so I put the rod down, slacking the line off, gone to get him, because I know I'm going to have to go in for it to clear this weed. It's the only way to actually get this weed past the other weed. And I've got this guy to come and hold the rod for me, and I've swam out there, tried to clear the weed off the line and move this weed bed. It's huge. I've got pictures of it. It's like, it's the biggest weed bed I've ever seen. You know, weighed, God knows what it weighed, but probably half a ton. You know, it was ridiculous. And I've got it free of this weed, and it's ran again, and this guy's got hold of the rod, so I've waded back in, picked the rod up, and it's now away from this weed bed, and it's got itself weeded up in another spot, like just the actual the marginal shelf now. It's quite deep at the base of that. So like, here we go again. But I knew now it's out of this main weed that's giving me the problem all night. So I've slackened the line off. This guy thought I was crazy, so I've slackened the line off, put the rod back on the buzzer with the old slack line technique again. I've put the kettle on, and this guy's looked at me going, "What are you doing?" I said, "Don't worry, it'll move off again." I knew now that it must have been well hooked, because it had got off in the night if it wasn't nailed. And I'd literally just lit the stove, and whee, away it goes again. And I picked it up, and it had come clear of the marginal shelf, and I just played it in like a normal fish. I had no weed around it whatsoever. Played it in and netted it. And, just under £47, which is, probably the most epic battle I've ever had. But because of the weed as opposed to the fish absolutely going sick, it was just the size of the weed bed and the physical side of the fish. It was never coming through it.
So yeah, that sounds like it was very lucky in the end.
It was never coming off. When I was using stiff links at the time, because of the bream on there, it slowed the bream down. There was lots of bream in there. Definitely caught less bream if I was using like the old Terry Hearn type stiff link.
The hinge stiffy.
Yeah, and it was nailed. It was 3 or 4 inches back, and that fish was never coming off. But from that, it was an epic battle. I would definitely give it an 8 from that. But I'm assuming you have a different story.
It's a story. I'll start by saying another 8, definitely. Right. I caught it from the other end of the lake, you know, just through these little kissing gates.
Yeah.
There was that set of pads into the cow field.
Yeah.
Well, I'd seen a few fish milling around there, and at that point, I'd not had a take from the lake. So, I'd not seen starburst, but I'd seen a couple of the small little river renegade, the commons. So I thought, one of those will do to start. My intention was to fish the end swim, because the cows were all around there, and I'll be honest, I do not like cows at all.
They were a nuisance in that field.
They are stupid animals. The only redeeming factor is that they're made of food.
I had to go to the garage to buy tow ropes, a bright orange and a bright blue tow rope, because they were kept wading in the water where the rods were and almost snapping the rods. They just wade straight through the rods, like I said, they're stupid creatures. And I had to basically make like a fence with big bright orange, and they're so stupid they could just walk straight through it, but they don't, because they just see a big orange and blue kind of fence. I made it with storm poles, like around the rods to the bivvy, and then the other side in kind of a triangle, just to try and keep them off my rods. And they were a pain in the arse, but the fish were always in there, so you kind of had to.
They were a pain, and like I say, my intention was to fish that end swim, which would have given me access to where the fish were. Only some dirty sod had had a big crap at the back of the swim. So I wasn't going to sit there with that for company. So threw a couple of branches at the cows. They gradually made their way off. So I set up just to the other side of the fence. Now, I don't know if you remember, but just to the left of those pads, the left corner, there was like a little gravelly clear patch. And to the right, it was really shallow, I'm talking like 18 inch 2 foot, with like candy floss algae sort of weed on the bottom. Now, I'd seen one of these little River Renegade commons, it had left the pads at the same spot at that side over all that mess twice, so I put a chod rig on there. I've only mind I'd only ever caught one fish on a choddy before. I wasn't overly confident, but I could see where the bait was. It was there, it was sat well, it was available to the fish, so I did it and sat well back. Now, while I was sat back, I could see some bow waves around the other side of that bay. So I filled my pocket full of pellets. I creeped round the other side just to drop a bit in the edge. I didn't get a chance. The choddy absolutely ripped off. So I legged it, well, I say legged it back round. My knee was playing up at the time, so I just kind of hopped and hobbled as quick as I could. Got back to the rod, struck into the fish, and it ran at least halfway up that bay. But it was also like on the island side, which is the near margin to where I was, and where the trees overhang around, if I remember rightly, there was 3 swims there on that side from the swim where the great big turd was lying. Between me and the swim where I'd had to get to net the fish, there was a barbed wire fence. Now, fortunately for me, the fish weeded itself up. I thought, right, I'm going to get round this fence and into the swims with the nets. I threw the net over there, and I'm a tall chap. I'm on my tiptoes over this barbed wire fence. The barbed wire is tickling me between the legs, and the fish is off again. It's very precarious. It's not something I want to repeat. But anyway, I gets over the fence, I crosses the first 2 swims, I manages to get the fish back. So I've seen what it was, because it had that nick out of the top lobe of its tail, if you remember.
Yeah.
I've seen it swimming round, and it just charged up and down and up and down. And I've got a great big ball of weed sat at the top of the lead core, probably 3 foot above where the fish is. I can't lift that physically out of the water with my rod. Netting the fish was not easy. I laid the net on the lake bed. I got the fish close enough over it. It's still a good couple of foot down. I scooped it up like a salmon while it was over it. As soon as I knew it was going in the net, I just dropped the rod in the water. Just picked the net up with both arms to scoop it up, and she was mine. That was 45-6 while I was having her.
Nice. So you're going to give it an 8 as well.
Yeah, that was a very memorable scrap.
Well, it looks like you may have actually won a Top Trumps. The I'm totaling this up. It's 8 all the way for the twin, which gives a total of 40 out of a possible 50. And there's a couple of 6s, a 5, a 9, and an 8, which makes 34 for Starbear. So this week's Top Trumps winner is Elstow 2's The Twin.
And that's a convincing win. I'm on a roll now.
So we're going to move over to our guest this week. We have Angling Royalty, I think, been a TV presenter on carp and rally stuff. Started the British Carp Championships, presented many programmes on TV, and all-round good guy. It's Mr. Rob Hughes. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie. Wow, that's an intro.
There was loads more. I started getting lost. I've got
keep going.
Loads of them. I missed out. Lawyer, world champion from, I think you did the first ever world championships with Crowe, didn't you? Fisherville, was it?
1996.
Wow.
Nearly 20 years ago, and I'm still dining out on it now. It's quite funny that, you know, you talk to some lads about competition carp fishing now, and I do have a little bit of a wry smile when they start telling me how to do it.
Well, competition must have kind of always been in the blood, I'm guessing. You know, you won the first ever world championship, and then you started the BCAC, which you know is still the best and biggest you know, match fishing for carp in this country.
Yes, it was. I think, like most anglers of our generation, you know, we started off fishing for various other things, and then, you know, you want to catch anything that swims, and then after you've caught a few things that swim, you want to catch lots of things that swim. Then you want to try and catch more than your mates, and then you want to try and catch bigger ones, don't you? So I think that's how a lot of us became carp anglers back in the day. So there's always been a little bit of a competitive element there. And, you know, going back to the 90s, the Enduro-style carp fishing, as it was called then, it was developed really by the French. And back in the UK, we were shunned to begin with. I know people said, oh, it'll never last. Competition carp fishing isn't for carp fishing. It shouldn't be allowed. It's not what we want to do. And obviously now, I started the BCAC in 1999. So what's that, 15-odd years ago? 16 years ago, it's still going strong. And there's more and more competitions developing. But until you've done it, you don't realise how thrilling it is. And I think you've had a go at it as well, haven't you? And,
yeah.
Suits some people, doesn't suit others, but don't knock it till you've tried it. It is good fun.
And what kind of better conclusion to that history of carp fishing than to be chosen to be England manager, which we've seen recently.
Yes, that's an appointment that's been given to me in the last couple of weeks. So it's pretty decent news, or recent news, should I say, at the moment, and obviously decent news for me too. And it's. I don't know how to describe the feeling of being able to represent your country. And it doesn't matter what your sport, what your discipline, what you do. When you put a shirt on that represents your country, then it means something special. And I've done it before on numerous occasions in the professional competitions, but to do it on world level as a manager, I think is a particular honour. You know, it really is. And competition carp fishing on the international scale is absolutely massive. And they take it incredibly seriously. And when I say incredibly seriously, I mean incredibly seriously. Yeah. Overseas, there's some massive money matches as well. So, they're very serious about it.
Yeah, we discussed it when I went out to Romania year before last. I mean, there was billboards of you and Frank Warwick up, you know, around lakes where they have competition. I was explaining to Mark who... and most sort of UK carp anglers listening to this, they won't know how big competition fishing is abroad. And Romania, I mean, there was an actual, you know, you could make a living off it, off fishing for carp at weekends. The prizes are quite big in some of these competitions, aren't they?
Oh, they're absolutely massive. You know, the Eastern European states in particular, we, as a prime example, if you speak to the majority of carp anglers in the UK about Romania, they have not got a clue what it's like over there. What they will think is Lake Reduta, and they'll think the odd big fish, and they'll think Romania is a big fish country with not much big fish fishing other than Lake Reduta, and nothing could be further from the truth. The position over there is that there was the English guys that went over there first back in 1998, I think it was either 98 or 99. There was me, there was Crowe, there was Kev Clifford, there was Rod Hutchinson, there was Mally Roberts, and five of us went over just after that lake had been discovered, and Romanian carp anglers didn't exist. They didn't exist. There were guys that fished for carp over there, and of course they just used to eat them because they needed them as a food source. But nobody, literally nobody over there, treated carp fishing as a sport. And they saw the Western style, I won't say the UK style, because there were Germans that went, there were French that went, there was various other nations that went over the period, and they saw the style of carp fishing that we do, i.e. the Western style, and they decided they liked it. But Reduta was particularly special in Romania because Robert Reduta looked after that lake. It was his own private hunting ground. So as a result, nobody could fish it. Now, most of the other lakes and rivers in Romania, they're fished by the locals and they take fish for the table. So as a result, there's not many big ones around. And to a degree, that's the same to this day, although they're promoting a no-kill policy and these fish are getting bigger now. So because they really like carp fishing, but they haven't got massive fish to go for, they went the other way and they went, right, let's go competition fishing. And there are literally dozens of competitions, just like our match scene over here where the float boys go out with poles. It's exactly the same over in Romania, but with carp fishing. They don't really pole fish over there. They have a float team, but it's primarily carp fishing matches. And there are matches from 10-peg knock-ups to 150-peg, you know, big 48, 72-hour enduros worth €30,000 every weekend.
Yeah, it's crazy. It blew me away, and it blew me away how... I mean, we're picking Romania as one country because you wouldn't really imagine a massive scene, but it is part of the culture over there as well, because like you said, they do eat them, so they've always kind of fished for them for food. But you know, the Two Brothers complex that I went to, I know you've been to a couple of times, they have two lakes, you know, one is no kill where they have the competitions and stuff, and the other one, you know, it is by the side of a restaurant, and you know, they kill them and eat them. It's barbecues in the pegs and all sorts.
That's it. It is a bit of a culture shock for us when we see it. But of course, we have to remember that carp were food fish in the first instance. So, you know, you see people going mad saying, oh, you can't do that with a carp. Well, actually, you know, we don't really think too much about mackerel. you imagine in 20 years' time, if there's a mackerel study group or we have competitions for mackerel and you've got to put them down on a mat by the side of the beach and then release them nicely after kissing them. You know, it's just what caught before and over there. That's what they're seen as. But the no-kill policy is growing over there, and there's more lakes. Like Tinkabeshti is the lake that you're talking about, the two yeah. Brothers Lake. You know, they have some absolutely magnificent events over there. And this is why these countries now are so, so strong on the international scene with regards to the, you know, the big competitions. I know that, unfortunately, being England manager is the sword of Damocles, really. You do well and it's fantastic. You don't do well and you're going to get battered by all sides. And I'm under no illusion that that will be exactly the same for me. It's been the same for anyone else that's put on an England manager shirt in whatever discipline you do. That's what the English seem to do. But you know, you can't underestimate any nation. And Romania won the World Championships 2 years ago on home turf. They're so used to catching an awful lot of fish, and they know what they're doing.
They're very skilled, yeah. Their tactics were, you know, as up to date as ours. There wasn't a lot they didn't know about when I went over there. You know, it's a couple of years ago. When was the last time UK had a decent run? In, you know, abroad in one of the World Championships?
We haven't done particularly well for a few years overseas in the FIPS World Championships. I think we've had a 17th and a 21st. The last time we did half decent was, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago when we had it at Brasenose and or at Linear on home turf when we had a 4th.
Yeah.
So it's really strange because if you split the competition scene into two different types, you've got FIPS, which is the Fédération Internationale Pêche Sportive. That's the official governing body, like FIA, you know, the footballers, like anything. They're the official world governing body, and they run amateur world championships. Now, when I use the word amateur, I use that in the dictionary sense, not in the they're amateur, so they're not very good. Amateur means unpaid. Professional means paid.
Yeah.
So with the World Championships, the FIPS World Championships, it's an amateur event in that you don't pay to enter. You don't pay and win any money on it. What you do is you win a gold medal.
Yeah.
So in the amateur events, we haven't really done that well. If you flip it and look at the professional events, which are, that's more like the PGA Tour, the golfers, the tennis players. You know, Andy Murray, when he goes out and plays tennis, yes, he's Scottish, he represents the UK, but he's not actually wearing UK colours because it's an individual's event as opposed to a team event.
Yeah.
You know, in those events, they win prize money. And if you look at the professional fishing side of things, we've done exceptionally well over the years, exceptionally well. For a start, the first ever World Championships, me and Simon won it. Then the second World Championships 4 years later, Tim Paisley and Steve Briggs won it.
Yeah, we remember that well.
It then disappeared to Germany when it went back to Romania for the event there, and Jürgen Becker won it. And then the next big World Championships event was over on the St. Lawrence, and lo and behold, Tim Paisley and Steve Briggs won it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you think out of the first big four World Championships, the Brits won it 3 times. Now, You have classics or big open events as well, like the World Carp Classic, which, you know, that's a massive event on the continental scene. I think that's been running 14 years now. And I think 10 times it's been won by the Brits.
So, I mean, obviously other countries have caught up to our methods. You know, we've pretty much invented it, I think. I don't know if you disagree, but, you know, we were certainly at the forefront. We had, you know, the first dedicated carp equipments with the likes of Kevin Nash and Fox as well. We've been doing it a long time. Has everybody else just caught up? And is that why? And maybe we haven't got there.
I think one of the problems here, and this might rankle a few people, is that we look at England as being the best all the time. We look into ourselves as being the place where it was all born, and therefore we're brilliant. And you can liken that to football as well. You know, football was born here. Are we the best in the world? Not really. We're competitive, but we're not the best.
No.
And the problem that we have, and this is where the keep it real thing comes in. You know, people talk about wrong'uns and they talk about foreign fish, and it's like, ah, that one don't count because it's from France. What a complete and utter load of rubbish.
Yeah.
What you've got to do is you've got to look at, firstly, are you fishing for your own enjoyment, in which case do you enjoy it? If you do enjoy it, more power to your elbow, but do what you want. If you don't enjoy it, have a look at yourself and ask yourself why you don't enjoy it, because you're probably doing it for the wrong reasons. But under no circumstances whatsoever does anybody at all have the right to criticise someone else's fishing.
No, it's a hobby and a pastime. You know, some people take it seriously and they're in it for the competition or the match fishing side of it, or whatever. But for most people, probably 95% of all people that go carp fishing, they're not going to sit on the Eightly or any of the other, you know, super famous syndicate lakes. They're going fishing to enjoy themselves as a pastime. And you know, Mark and I were talking earlier in the section, we were discussing bait boats and stuff and technology in general and how it's going to affect fishing in the future. We're talking about the possibility of drones, you know, flying over the lake looking for fish, and that's going to be a reality within, I'm sure there's carp anglers that already own them now with GoPros fitted, you know, wired to an iPad. Well, but, you know, if you want to go and make things as easy as possible and enjoy catching fish, then why shouldn't you?
Exactly. You know, the mountaineering is another massive hobby of mine. And I'm going to liken fishing to mountaineering. Now, if you climb to the top of Mount Everest, you've got to the pinnacle of the world as far as mountaineering is concerned. You know, you arrive at the very top of the highest mountain, and you can only do that one way, and that's through hard graft. Yeah. Now, if somebody run a chairlift up the side of it, and anybody could go and pay 50 quid or 500 quid or 5,000 quid, hop on the chairlift, get to the top and have a photograph at the top, fair play to them. You know, if they want to do that, fair play. But if they turn around and go, look at me, I'm an awesome mountaineer, that's where I find the issue is. And it's not necessarily about the result, it's about the journey, that makes any sense.
Yeah, so that's a very good point. It kind of summed up what we spent 20 minutes talking about before. It's like some people want to make it as hard as possible because of the achievement level of doing it. So I'm saying with that respect, then why would you use a modern rod that can cast 160 yards? You know, try and wait till them fish come in and fish your sensor pin reel and the split cane rod, sort of Chris Yates style. You know, we don't think twice about using bite alarms, you know, being able to go to sleep and fish 24 hours a day. So you know, why would we be worried about other advancements in technology? But some, you know, the kind of the underground, the keep it reels, they want to make it as, or certainly make it appear as big an achievement as it possibly can be. And you know, if you're going to do that, then why are we not still, you know, putting our feet under umbrellas and with no bibbies, getting wet, and you know, using rods that can't get the distances we need to get to the fish sometimes? And
I tell you what, Jamie, we've both been there in the past, and I'm so glad that we're not. I remember waking up with my feet hanging out the side of a 45-inch brolly, and it soaked all the way through, and the sleeping bags just pulling it all the way back up again. It was awful.
Yeah, bin bags we used to take. We used to put bin bags up. Even they weren't as good as they are now.
The problem with bin bags, though, your feet always used to sweat, didn't they?
Yeah, it was an endurance test. You know, 48 hours on the bank and with the equipment in the early 80s was an endurance test. And, it, you know, now you can spend months and have the creature comforts of home. But it's like you say, I mean, you know, if you want to climb to the top of Everest and do it, you know, properly, you're going to feel great. You know, your personal feeling of achievement is going to be great forever. It's something, you know, but like you say, if somebody wants to go to the top in the chairlift just because they want to go to the top of Everest, that's great too. And I'm sure they'll have some great pictures, but that's the distinction you make is a good one, that, you know, don't say you're the best mountaineer if you went up in a chair. And I'm guessing if you catch, you know, the most prestigious carp in the country and you did it without casting a line, and you know, you found the fish with a drone and you sent a bait boat to the spot, then it's not the same as if you know, you walk around the lake stalking it with a bit of cord on the end of the rod. I suppose.
No, that's right. But ultimately, and you know, people, I think one of the biggest problems in carp fishing these days is there is a little bit of bitchiness and jealousy around, which is crazy, really. Unfortunately, we're human beings, and you've only got to watch EastEnders in the evening to know that the majority of the time people like to argue with each other, and if you're not arguing, you like to watch other people argue, which is a bit of a sad state of affairs, really. It's much better going out and just doing what you want to do. But you know, if you look at it, I've climbed to the top of Everest under my own steam, get to the top, happy days. There's a bloke who comes up on a chairlift next door to me. He's there. We're both up there at the same time. You know what? It doesn't make any difference, does it?
No.
As long as he's not looking down at everyone else saying he's the best mountaineer in the world, the fact that he's gone up there on his chairlift doesn't make any difference whatsoever to me. Really doesn't.
This is where the problem lies in fishing, because you know what happens is that that same picture, you know, the guy that's done it the hard way and the guy that's done it the easy way, that same picture ends up on the front cover of Carp Talk or a different magazine. The guy gets a bait deal, or he already had one, you know. And for the layman who maybe hasn't got the time or dedication to or the money to fish that type of lake, they're looking at it enviously, and you know, and they want to criticize the catcher. And in some cases they might be right, and you know, and but other times people make sacrifices to be in that position to you know, it might appear from the outside, oh, he's sponsored by, you know, X company, and he can put more bait in than me, and he fishes 5 days a week. But because people are kind of, they have the same goal, they both want to be stood at the top of Everest, or they both want to be holding the fat lady or whatever it is, it ends up being that, I don't know if it's competition is the right word, but the comparison is there. And you know,
I think that's the issue, that you know, it's not necessarily competition, it's comparison. And ultimately this is where people interfering in other people's fishing or having an opinion about other people's fishing really shouldn't, you just shouldn't do it, because it doesn't matter. You know, you should fish for yourself. You should do what you want to do. And if your motive is to either belittle someone else or get one over on someone else, again, have a look at yourself.
Yeah, I'm pleased when someone catches a fish, you know, especially if they're on the lake, because we all know that feeling, that exhilaration, that, you know, it's one of the world's natural highs. Maybe the same as, you know, standing at the top of Everest or whatever it is.
But you don't want your target fish snatched from under your nose.
True.
But again, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? Everyone's out trying to catch certain fish, and if you're on that sort of water and everybody's out trying to catch it, then if someone else has got it, fair dues to them. They've got it.
Human beings come before anything for me, like and just the buzz of, even if it's a fish, I know I'm going to catch it eventually. You know, it might have put me back a year if that fish comes out once a year and somebody catches it, but I will enjoy the moment of them being, because I know what that buzz is like, you know, when you stood there, like say after a year, two seasons, three seasons, you catch that fish, that feeling, that high, that natural high is you know, as good as it gets. And I can enjoy somebody watching somebody else have that feeling as well, and be genuinely pleased for him, you know. Yeah, it might be a tiny bit of disappointment going, right, that's its only capture for this year, you know, I'm back next season. But you know, that's happened to me a number of times, and it just makes it all the better when you catch it. Not to mention, you've just learnt something when this other person's caught it. You know, you're looking there and going, right, it's come out on this time of year, on, you know, from this peg. You're still learning.
I think you're bang right. I think there's no problem with other people catching fish, as long as they're not doing it in the World Championships against England. Well, <That's it. laughs> yeah, let's get back onto that one again, because the gloves are well and truly off when we've got the shirts on.
So where is the next competition then? What are you kind of picking and training for then? What's the goal?
Well, yeah, the event takes place in October, and it's at Casp in Spain on the River Ebro.
All right.
So it's on one of the dams as opposed to on the main river, so hopefully the flow shouldn't be too much. I've got a reasonable amount of experience on the Ebro. Obviously, some of your listeners might know that I used to run a holiday company, and one of the places we used to send people to was the Ebro. So I've been going out there for 10 or 12 years. Not so much in recent years. But, you know, you get a feel for what you're going to be fishing for. It's quite nice, actually, because FIPS in the past have come under quite a lot of criticism. And I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I'm not a man to hide under a bushel. If I've got an opinion, I'll give it. I think FIPS quite rightly have come under quite a bit of criticism in the past for their venue choices, because as carp fishing goes, we want to be catching what we would class as proper carp. And going out and trying to catch 3 and 4 pounders is not what I class as carp fishing. I think that is all right for the feeder boys. You know, if they're going out with the feeders and they're shorter rods, but when we're carp fishing, we want to carp fish. And if we're carp fishing, we want something that's going to pull back. And 3 and 4 pounders don't cut the mustard. So in the past, it's been run on a couple of venues where the fish are too small. Spain this year, I think they've got it right. I think it should be a good venue. The carp are of a decent size. And I think tactics-wise, we've got... It plays to our strengths a little bit, because one of the things that you see on some of the venues that's been run on so far, particularly the big shallow lakes, is that and you've witnessed this firsthand out at Tinkabeshti, some of these foreign anglers are absolute brutes when it comes to casting.
Yeah, oh yeah, some of the best I've ever seen.
Absolutely incredible, and you know, we think we're talented. I tell you what, you go out and stand next to the Russians, the Croatians, the Romanians, the Yugoslavians, the South Africans, and the list goes on. They're just the first five teams that come into my head, and almost to a man, every person can cast in the team 200 yards plus.
Yeah.
They are absolute animals. They're beasts, they're strong, and they do not know when to give up. And when you're on a shallow, sandy lake like some of the venues that have been fished so far, you put 25 teams in a line, the bloke that casts the furthest is probably going to have the advantage over and above everyone else.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, particularly if they can put bait out, and they can put bait out to that range. And, you know, and I'm not knocking our boys at all, because our boys are capable of doing that, but we don't practice it because there's nowhere that we do it. There's very, very few places that you consistently have to fish 160 yards plus. Whereas when they're out doing their competitions day in, day out, weekend in, weekend out, and they're all casting 160 yards plus, their long range fishing is brilliant.
Yeah, that seems to be, we noticed it at Tinkabeshti. And, you know, I met the guy who's actually, he's the, you know, the national champion caster. He spent a lot of time with us because we were with Terry Edmonds as well, who's obviously an amazing caster.
Yeah, he can chug.
You know, he wasn't quite as far as Terry, but he was definitely more accurate because he's used to fishing like that, you know, every time he goes fishing, because all the lakes are sort of long. There's a couple of lakes up north. You've got the motorway, not the motorway, the A1 pits that's all kind of long range. I remember Horseshoe was like that, you know, the person that could cast the furthest would catch more than everyone else, especially off the sort of winter bank and stuff years ago. And we've got the Wire up here, but even the Wire, the longest chuck's about 140. But until you fish those lakes week in and week out, you get out of practice. You know, if I go on a lake where I have to cast again, you know, a significant distance, 100 plus, you forget how hard you have to whack it. And
absolutely, I think that when it comes to tactics or techniques, more to the point, we're far ahead of everyone else when it comes to rigs. We're very, very good when it comes to finesse. What we lack is brute force and ignorance, effectively. Smash it out to 200 yards, shove a lot of bait around it, get a big hook out there and catch whatever comes in, reel it in as quickly as possible and smack it back out again. And you know, sometimes these events can be all in wrestling. And we're perhaps boxing, and we need to put a bit more brute force behind it. But you know, I'll just come back to a point that you made a second ago, and this is a very, very key issue. When you were out at Tinkabeshti in Romania, you met the Romanian carp casting champion.
Yeah, we don't have one.
We don't have one. Why don't we have one? Because we don't do that sort of thing. Whereas they actually have tournaments, interestingly, with big money prizes on it as well.
Yeah,
because they love a gamble over there, don't they? They have big money prizes for who can cast the furthest.
Is the Ebro going to be the same? Are you going to need the casters for that team?
No, because with it being a river valley, it's a little bit shorter range fishing.
Right.
Depending on where, you know, there's going to be areas that are slightly longer because of where they're pegged. But on the whole, you know, it goes quite deep, quite quick in certain places. So, you know, depending on what the flow's like, you may not need to be as far out. However, whatever the position is, you're going to be in a line with a load of blokes.
Yeah.
So, you know, then it might come down to baiting strategies, so on and so forth. Until I see the match stretch, I won't know. And, you know, I'll go over at some stage and have a recce slightly earlier on in the year, see what the stretch is like. One of the difficulties with the Ebro in particular, and it can be said for any of these events when you go out and look to recce and practice on them, but because this one's a river, it's very, very different. What it looks like now will be nothing like what it looks like in June, and in June it will be absolutely nothing like it will be in August, and in August it will be absolutely nothing like it will be in October, because that water level's up and down and up and down and up and down. So you know, you don't really know what the flow is going to be. You can fish it one day and it'll be different the next.
So how many guys do you need for the team? How are you going to go about selecting the right people?
Well, the team's made up of four competing pairs and then a support crew around the outside of it. So as far as the competing pairs are concerned, there are three sections, So three pairs get to fish, one pair is a substitute pair. But you don't necessarily have to substitute a full pair out. You can pull one man off, put one man on, etc., etc., etc. I have some ideas on what I'm going to do with regards to selection and who I'm going to be, not necessarily who I'm going to be using, but how I'm going to be running the selection process on that. And I'll make that public at some stage in the not too distant future. Bear in mind, I've only been in seat for about a week. There's a few things that I need to sort out with people that I want to come on board to assist me with the management squad, etc., etc. So until I've run everything past them, I'm not going to go public on the way that we're going to be running things or who is likely to be in the squad.
Okay, so it's like the football. You'll have a squad and then you'll spend some time with those and then select a team from the squad type.
Yes,
a bit like the football would.
And yeah, basically.
And then we get kiss and tell stories on the manager in the sun, do we?
I'm sure there will be at some stage. It's, that's such is the nature of the British love of their national managers. But I'm old enough, ugly enough, and having done 13 years at the helm of the British Carp Angling Championships, I'm probably experienced enough to deal with any flack that anybody wants to throw. But the main aim at the moment is what I would like to do is I would like, and I put a plea out to all of the listeners here, I would like everybody to get behind Team England on this, because you know what? I'm not interested in egos. I'm not interested in attitude. I'm not interested in prima donnas. What I'm interested in is people wearing three lines on their shirt with pride and actually pulling their hearts out and fishing their socks off for their country. And if anybody's got an agenda other than that, they can sit themselves in a corner and speak to themselves, come back and have a word with me afterwards. And if they don't like it, they know where the door is.
And is the door open for absolutely anyone? If there's anyone listening to this that thinks, I think I'm good enough to do that. Is the door open for anybody to prove himself to you?
Absolutely.
Good.
In the past, there has been some criticism levelled at management squads that have picked people for either commercial reasons or alternatively for personal reasons, or they've taken a mate along. I'm not going to make any comment on that. I'm not going to make any comment on any previous managers' capabilities, abilities or anything at all that they've done, because I want to look forward, not backwards. I will say that you have to take into consideration history, because history shapes the future. So we'll look at what's gone on. We'll look at the positives, take them forwards. We'll look at the negatives, see if we can fix them. And as far as I'm concerned, it is open to everybody and anybody that wants to come forwards. I would also like to try and get a lot of the trade together behind everything too, because once again, this is a national squad. Now, there isn't a fishing company out there that won't have benefited in some way, shape or form from lads going competition carp angling, whether it's a bloke buying some ESP hair stops or someone buying 50 kilo of Nash bait to take out on an event this weekend. So what I would like to do is I'd like to try and get the support of all of the trade behind this, as well as the public.
I'm sure they will. Is there an official team sponsor this year, like there has been previously?
No, there isn't. Calder have done an absolutely fantastic job over the last 3 years. And I've got to say at this point, Danny Fairbrass gets a lot of stick from a lot of people, but he does an awful lot behind the scenes that people don't know about. And fair dues to him. He put his money where his mouth is with regard to the England team, and he funded them for an awful lot of money over the years. Prior to that, a lot of people don't know that he put a lot of money into Echo. He's also helped with regards to funding for the Angling Trust, and at the moment he's got Embryo. So fair dues to Dan. You know, he deserves no criticism whatsoever because he puts a lot into it. But moving forwards, I don't want Team England to be sponsored by one company. I want Team England to be open to everybody, because as soon as you have one company, you have company bias, and you have also the allegation that they're only in it because.
Yeah.
Now, that may or may not happen, but it certainly won't happen on my watch. What I'm saying is that it is Team England.
Yeah, we mentioned that when we heard about your appointment in last week's show. The first thing I said was that, you know, in the past there has been allegations that certain people have been dropped because of, you know, commercial, political reasons, really. And I said that you're probably the straightest guy I've ever met. You know, there will be no influence. It'll be what is best for England. And, you know, I'm sure you'll listen to last week's podcast at some time. You hear me say that there's nobody I could pick that would be better for this job, both on a, you know, on an unbiased level, and the fact that you've got God knows how many years foreign experience. You know, like you say, you've owned travel companies that have visited all these places abroad. You're a superstar abroad. You and Frank, I mean, I was gobsmacked when we went to Romania. You know, big posters. And as soon as they find out you're English, do you know Rob Hughes? Do you know Frank Warwick? You know, that's, and Simon Crowe, obviously, as well. And every single person you meet, that's the first thing that comes out of the mouth. Oh, I know Rob. I met him. I fished with him in this competition. It's like, you guys are superstars out there. So you're going to get the respect of all the other countries, you know, as soon as you turn up. So I think it's great news for England, and I'm looking forward to seeing you holding up those trophies, I think, in the not too distant future.
Well, thanks ever so much for that, and you know, again, it is, I'm certainly not taking it lightly. It's an honour that's been bestowed on me, and I can think of nothing better. You know, having stood on the top level of a podium, hearing the national anthem blaring out, it's just absolutely electrifying. And Jamie, as I'm speaking to you now, I've just had a shiver down my spine and the hairs on my arms have just stood up.
That's what an English manager and everybody representing England should be feeling, you know, at every stage of the selection process through to, you know, fishing for the country. So, I mean, what gave the fire in your belly for travelling abroad? What sort of age were you when, I'm assuming it was you and Crowe that just took off in a motor one day? And what?
Well, it was sort of. I Rod Hutchinson in 1986 caught a fish of, it was either 56 or 54 pounds, and I can't remember exactly the weight, but I can remember the picture of it because it was held up over a lilo. Mm. And I remembered as a carp angler seeing that fish thinking, I want a bit of that, because it was bigger than anything anybody'd seen before, as far as, you know, the people in the UK were concerned. Bear in mind that I would be 15, 16 years old then. So I grew up in a small town called Oswestry in Shropshire, and there weren't really that many carp lakes in the northwest. There was one or two lakes in Shropshire, but nothing within 5 or 10 miles of me. Now, I say 5 or 10 miles because if anybody knows Oswestry Street, they'll know there's a load of hills around it. And as a 14-year-old kid trying to pedal there on a pushbike up and down the hills, you know, there was Ellesmere is where there's lots of lakes. It's got a famous area now. Yeah. But there was a massive barrier between Oswestry Street and Ellesmere. It's only 8 miles apart, but that barrier was called the Brow. And you couldn't push bike up it. You had to walk and push your kit as well. And it was a long old way. So as a result, it was a special treat. Now, the cart world opened up to me when I was 16 because I got a moped. And what that meant is I could get back up the Brow within a reasonable period of time. So my cart fishing properly started at 16. Although, you know, I was fiddling around before then.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, as a 16-year-old fishing for, if I was lucky, mid upper double fish, to see something that was mid 50 pound. It yeah. just absolutely blew my socks off. And most of us will remember one particular photograph that really set the fire burning, and that was the one for me. And I thought, you know what? As soon as I'm old enough to drive, I'm having a bit of that. So I passed my test when I was 17 in the November. And then the following May, decided I was going to France. Now, I hadn't got a clue where I was going, what I was doing. So I found out where Cassian was and realised that for a Mark 1 Ford Escort, it was probably a little bit too far. Yeah. So I ended up teaming up with a lad called Neil Bannister, who's from Winsford. We used to fish the Top Flash together, if anybody knows him or the lake up there.
Well known in the northwest, yeah.
It was the 87, 88, I think I was there, up to 89, and then Bernard Loftus came on and destroyed absolutely everything up there with fish mills, caught the lot in no time at all, and it was like, wow, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
So we walked away with a tail between our legs. But, I teamed up with this lad called Neil, and we decided we were going to go to France. And we literally just got on a boat and went blue spotting, and it was absolutely fantastic. It was incredible, the excitement then. Night fishing was illegal everywhere, so you weren't allowed to night fish. Excuse me. we used to go around and have a little bit of a game of cat and mouse here, there and everywhere. And we were fishing for 20s with a chance of a 30 then, which, you know, again, don't sound big in this day and age, but back then they were massive.
And did you catch plenty of fish that first trip?
Caught a few actually that first trip, and that was me hooked, absolutely hooked. The old 2.25 pound Northwestern carbon Kevlars, they couldn't cope with these big foreign fish, so I had to invest in a pair of 3 pound Harrison Ballistas, which at the time were major league casting tools. But I moved to Wolverhampton from Oswestry in 1989, Maybe it was 1990, mine's going. And I bumped into a lad in the tackle shop who I just immediately got on with. And you know, sometimes you meet someone and you immediately become friends. Yeah. And you've only known him a few minutes, but you think, you know what, that bloke's all right.
Yeah.
He spoke his mind. He's as straight as a die. We got on really, really well. And that bloke was Simon Crowe. And he was working as a Wednesday lad in a tackle shop called Steve Babbs in Wolverhampton. I was a trainee solicitor at the time, and the tackle shop was the place to go at lunchtime, not knowing anybody. So we made friends, and it was close season time back then as well. You couldn't fish between March and June. So he used to go down to Cornwall. And I said, the next close season, what are you doing? And he went, oh, I'm going down to Cornwall fishing Tamar. And I said, why on earth do you bother going all the way over there when you can get to France almost as quick? And he said he'd never been. So lo and behold, we packed the old escort estate up and trundled over there and went out. And that was it. Love affair born. We were out fishing overseas all the time.
I used to fish Lower Tamar in the close season.
Did you?
Yeah, went there a few times before I could drive. There was a holiday park nearby in Bude that... family used to go, my sister used to go horse riding, and they used to drop me off at the lake for a week and bring me some food every day. I was about 14, 15.
There's going to be young guys listening now that didn't realise that there was a close season.
Yeah, and you could use three rods as well.
Yes.
Down there, and you couldn't anywhere else. So it was great. And then you were saying about going to France when you passed your driving test. I'd been past a week and went to Lower Tamar. That was the, you know, I was a bit young probably for France, but and didn't know anything about it. But it was, yeah, Lower Tamar was the first place I went. But I remember my nan saying to me, "You're not driving that far. You just passed your test." And because I was staying with her at the time, and I just decided to go at like midnight, and middle of the night. Just thought, right, I'm going, and then.
But what
really
an adventure, though, Jamie! What an adventure! How excited were you driving down the M5?
Oh yeah, and I'm envious now that you were doing that to France, because I've literally discovered France in the last year and a half. You know, I've still only been a couple of times. I went to Romania, and that's my future, to be honest. Now I think is I'm done with the hardcore 4 nights a week fishing, you know, for name fish in the UK. It's exploring for me now, you know. Transporter will be coming this year, and that's what's exciting me now, to think of that, which is why I'm interested. You were doing that from such an early age, and you know, heading down the M5 to Tamar was exciting. We used to fish them all. We'd go to college, you know, because they were all on one ticket. You could get like a week.
So Jennets, wasn't there? Jennets, Tamar, college. What was another one?
I think there was like five. You could fish them all, or five or six of them, and I would do like a night on one, and if nothing was happening, I'd be in the car. I'd had an escort, actually, a Mark II escort at the time. And
good lad.
We'd be off to the next one, and I've been on my own. I remember nights sleeping in the car when the weather was too bad and I wasn't sure which lake I was going to fish the next day. And, you know, it is exciting and slightly scary thinking back now, but I mean, doing that at that age abroad must have been such a buzz.
I said about Romania and there not being any carp anglers there. In France, there was hardly any. You know, back then in the late 80s, early 90s, you'd got the Mahon brothers, you got Phil Lagab, you got Didier Cottin down south, and there was a handful of others, but it was like a very, very early group of carp anglers. So the French pioneers were out there doing it, but it wasn't mainstream in France at all. You know, now there's thousands and thousands and thousands of carp anglers over in France, as indeed, you know, in lots of other countries, but back then there weren't any. And if you found a French carp angler, we used to go around trying to find French carp anglers, because we thought, if there's a French carp angler on here, it must be worth fishing.
Yeah.
Because they're going to know the places more than us. So we'd literally just drive around lakes looking for French carp anglers. And if there was one there, and, you know, it's a little bit jumping on a bike. We didn't jump in the swim next door to them, obviously. But if they were on a lake, you'd know there was something worthwhile going for.
Yeah.
And just interestingly on that point, I've been out travelling quite a bit recently into different countries. Like last weekend, I was over in the Czech Republic with Fox. The weekend before, I was in Poland with Fox again. Part of my job with Fox is doing the international ambassadorial role. So we go around, it sounds ever so grand, but basically go around the international trade shows. So there's a UK presence there as well. Yeah. And I first went to the Czech Republic in 1999. And the difference there between what it is now and what it was then is absolutely incredible. Once again, there weren't really westernized carp anglers over there, but there were some guys there that were the pioneers at the time. And interestingly, one of them runs a magazine and the other one runs the main fishing shop, the Tackle Box, as it is in Prague. Yeah. And they came up and said, "We remember you when you were here last time." It's like, wow, that was 15 years ago.
They probably stuck in their mind because, like you said, they probably weren't seeing many foreign, well, many of their own nationality anglers, let alone, two crazy guys flying over from England. So, they're not going to forget you, I don't think. But
yeah, no, it was brilliant fun. We drove, actually, that first Czech trip. that was a long way.
And what's your favourite country now? I mean, what's got the fondest memories?
That's a difficult one. I went to South Africa in 99.
Yeah.
And that trip will always stand out to me as being an incredible trip because we were fishing in the middle of the bush. We'd heard that there was a crazy Englishman called Martin Davidson over there who quite liked carp fishing, and he'd found a lake that had got some carp in. Obviously, a lot of the settlers in South Africa were either Dutch or English, and over the years they'd taken carp in the boats. So where they got the ballast and the fresh water in the bottom of the boats to keep them steady, they put carp in as well so they could eat them on the way over. And when they got there, they released them at the river systems. And of course, they populated South Africa quite well. So lo and behold, there's this guy over there that's fishing for carp. And he said, "If you ever fancy a real adventure, come over and see us." So we went over there and we're literally, we're in a tent in the middle of the African bush. There's lions roaring. Wow. We had some absolutely superb fishing as well. Crowe typically caught the biggest one. He had one at, I think it was 56. I had three over 40, which was, again, a magnificent result over there. We caught an absolute shed load of carp. And it was just an amazing experience.
And were you fishing Meduta in the really big fish times there, sort of prior to the fish kill?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We
you just dropped out a bit there.
Austria. It was discovered when a fish was taken into a taxidermist in Vienna. And one of our very good friends, a guy called Kurt Grabmeier, and a couple of other guys had got contacts with this taxidermist. And they said, "Look, if any big fish come in, do tell us." Right. So lo and behold, the phone rings and it's like, "You're not going to believe what's turned up on my desk." And they've said, "What?" And he said, "A carp bigger than anything I've ever seen before." And it was 78.5 pounds, and it equaled Marcel Rouvier's record at the time.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the world record at that time, 78 pound River Yon. Nothing had been caught anywhere near it. Nothing anywhere at all. And suddenly some blokes pitched up from Romania with a carp equally as big as the world record and said, "Can you stuff this for me?" So of course, Helly and Kurt and also Jürgen have said, "Right, where's this place? Let's get in touch with them and let's see what we can do." So they've gone over there. And they fished it first. They said, "You fancy coming?" And we couldn't, for whatever reason, we couldn't go. They went in the September, and they said it's unbelievable. They caught a 60, and then they went again in the October, November, caught fish again, 50s and 60 pounders, which back then that was the equivalent of, Euro Aqua 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
So, but these, bearing in mind, these are wild fish in a fairly big lake. So the following May, we got a party together and went over there. And this was the initial trip with me, Crowe, Kev Clifford, Rod and Mally. And we went over there and had a little go over there. And it was amazing seeing it. What an adventure that was. You just didn't know what was in there. The lake had hardly been scratched and it had already done a 78 pounder. One of the 70 pounder had been caught as well, which, again, modern day equivalent, that's a 90 or 100 pound fish.
Yeah, definitely. Is that where your PB's from?
No, it's not actually. My PB's from Rainbow.
Ah, right.
So I've been lucky enough to catch a couple over 70 pound. I had a 75 pound 14 ounce mirror from Rainbow, and then I managed to tag a 70 pound 10 ounce common from Germany. So I've braced the 70 pounders, which is a pretty decent feat, although they're growing all the time now, aren't they? And I think Mark Ryder, he's actually done 90s. He's done two 90s now.
It's from EuroAqua.
He's had one from EuroAqua. And he had another one. He had Scar from Graviers.
Yeah.
So, you know, this, but this, I think you can't be too disillusioned. There's going to be people listening to this that you know, we might as well be talking alien language now with fish this big. And it's, if you want to go out and catch a big fish, the best advice I can give you is go to a lake that's got one in it. Because if you're not, you know, everyone says, oh, is there a secret to it? Yeah, go and fish where they are.
Yeah, that's definitely.
The secret. You know, you're not going to catch a 60 pounder if there's not one swimming in front of you, and that could be a 40, a 30, a 20, or even a double. So, you know, if you really want to catch your first 20 pounder, go to a lake not with a 20 in it, but ideally with a lot of them, and don't try and fish for one 20 pounder. Just fish for anything that comes along, and if there's lots of 20s in there, the chances are one will pick your bait up at some stage.
Exactly. And I my PBs are bigger in England than they are abroad, so I've still got it all to do abroad. I mean, I've not been to the Lights of Rainbow. Anyway, yeah, I've been to Luke's place, but in the summer.
You've got a massive UK PB, though, haven't you?
Yeah, I've had 50 mirrors and commons in the UK, which, you know, I think the French PB is like 46. So yeah, I've still got a few goals abroad. Well,
We used to have something that was a target that people wanted to set, and it was just me and my mates used to do, and it was, are you in the ton club?
Yeah.
And the ton club is that you need your PB from overseas and the UK to be over £100. So you've actually done it, but the other way around.
just in the UK, yeah. I'm looking forward to the exploring the public lakes and stuff, and so I'm interested in other countries. I really enjoyed the passion that people had, and the fact it's part, hunting's part of the culture in Romania, and I'm looking for those sort of countries, you know, as well as the obvious. I mean, France is a beautiful country, and there's obviously lots of carp to go out in lots of different types of lakes, so I'm going to be doing plenty of exploring. But, you know, I like the look of, I remember seeing Slotoplas near Amsterdam at some point, you know, years ago. As a guy I know used to run trips out there, Mark, he was called, I think, and I was actually watching Bon Jovi in concert at the Amsterdam Arena, and I knew he was there, so we just shot over on the train to see him, and I was just like, I've still never fished it, but just those sort of lakes, just exploring different cities around Europe and just finding stuff. I don't think there's that much pioneering to be done, you know, although that's the sort of fishing I've done in England.
There's loads, Jamie, of pioneering to be done. It just depends on what your target is.
Yeah, I mean France, but the other countries, definitely. I mean, if you're going, I suppose most of your trips are work-based now, are they, when you go abroad? But, I mean, if you're going for absolute pleasure, what country would you pick?
I've got a bit of a hankering for Poland at the moment. I fished in Poland the first time, was it last year or the year before? I think it was the year before last. And the Polish guys are great. There's such a nice scene over there. And the editor of the Polish carp magazine, Carp Max, he's invited me over to a lake over there that is, it's been private for a long time, and it's a little bit of an unknown. So it's an unknown lake in a bit of an unknown country.
Yeah.
If I was going for a pleasure trip tomorrow, I would probably go to France through convenience. I wouldn't necessarily fish a commercial. If I was going for an adventure, I'd certainly head east.
Yeah.
And that would be into one of the Eastern European countries, be it Czech Republic, be it Hungary, be it Romania. There's a lake on the quiet that's just been discovered in Romania at the moment that's producing it's produced one or two very big fish so far. I'm sure it will produce more as it gets a little bit more attention. And I have the opportunity of going out there. And this is another piece of advice that I give anybody at all. If you've got any pioneering spirit in you, if you hear about something, get on it straight away.
Yeah,
I missed a trick in 1992 because I was told about this lake where you could go and catch 10 30-pound fish in a night. And quite frankly, I didn't believe it. And then I was talking to my French friend about it, and he said it's a place called Dare. And then I was talking to an English bloke who'd spoken to a different French bloke who'd said it was a place called Shanticoque. Yeah. And I thought, well, there can't be two. Anyway, it turned out to be the same place. But I didn't believe it and didn't go there until it was too late. And when I say too late, there was loads and loads of people queuing up to go there. You know, Euro-Aqua in Hungary, that was another place. I must say, I was the second Englishman to go over there. I got beaten by Steve Weir by a week, managed to get in over there. It's not really my cup of tea, to be fair. It's a little bit too commercial. Each to his own, no problem whatsoever. There's some fantastic fish in there. There's some massive fish in there, but it's a little bit too commercial for me. But if you get the opportunity, Reduta, very, very early. Cassian fished that in 96, late. In the history of Cassian, but actually probably on its second renaissance, because remember, things go round and round and round, and what might have been trendy in the past has been forgotten about, but those fish will still be in there, they'll regenerate. And you've only got to look at like the Delchanthacoch at the moment to see that there's an absolutely ginormous common in there, and that lake now is probably on par, if not better, than the Orient. Whereas a lot of people think, oh, it's not worth looking at, the fish have died, etc, etc, etc. A lot of them have died, but the ones that are left have grown.
Yeah, I've even in my sort of relatively short UK fishing career, I've seen lakes go in cycles. You know, the big ones have gone, and then, you know, the next lot have come through, and it's already happening over here. So I'm sure, you know, I mean, they grow bigger and faster abroad because of the temperatures. So, you know, I'm sure it's even more the case there. And like Reduta is coming back round again, isn't it? I mean.
It is, but Reduta's changed a little bit in that it's producing, or it's started to produce, quite a lot of big fish again. And those Fresinet commons that were in there, the beautiful big golden round ones,
yeah.
They were the ones that grew to the big size, and the mirrors were the broodstock of those. But of course, there were some little ones in there they grew on. The problem is that Robert's decided now that he earns more money from sturgeon farming than he does from carp, and as a result he's put loads and loads and loads of sturgeon in there.
Right.
So whilst the carp are in there, it's a little bit like Pool Hall. Do you remember Pool Hall in the Midlands?
Yeah.
It's like Pool Hall used to be. You know, there were three 30-pounders, including a 38-pound common in there, but there was about 15,000 3 to 5 pound cricketback commons that you had to get through first.
Yeah.
So Reduta is a little bit like that now. There are some good fish in there, but there's an awful lot of other stuff to try and get through, which makes it a very, very difficult proposition for a big fish.
And then we've been talking nearly an hour and we haven't even got near to the underwater stuff yet, which is, I'm sure lots of listeners have seen your stuff in Carpology and various mags. It's that you're seeing it in front of your own eyes, all the stuff that we've been guessing for years and years and years, you know. You're seeing how the bait lands out of spots and spoms, how our rigs are landing, where our line's pinned up, and it's just like, that's like the questioning, isn't it? That's like, you know, I'm sure that's what everybody talks to you about these days, isn't it? It's you know, do they really sleep, you know? Can they see us? Can they see our line? What's kind of the most eye-opening thing you've learned since you've been diving?
Ooh, why don't you put me on the spot?
what was a real aha moment?
Let's have a look. I think I do a number of talks. I'll be doing a talk up at the Northern Angling Show, obviously with you guys, in a few weeks' time. But I've done a few talks where I look at all sorts of things, from the carp and its environment, rigs, how they work, tangles, how they occur, all sorts of bits and bobs. And one of the things that I've just got so used to, because I see it all the time, but every time I do the slideshow, people always come up and go, wow, you know what? I didn't know that. And that is, silt is not black.
Right.
Everybody seems to think that silt is black, whereas it isn't. If you, when you go underwater, everything has a slightly green tinge.
Yeah.
And it has a green tinge in freshwater because freshwater has algae. And when the sun shines through the algae, basically the green light gets filtered through more than any other colour. Also, the light's bouncing off the algae, which is green. So the weed is green. Everything underwater has a greeny tinge. So for a start, if green light shines on something, it's going to have a green tinge.
Yep.
However, if you look at, if you don't clean your house and you run your finger along the top of the telly, the chances are there's going to be dust there. The bottom of a lake is like that. You get suspended stuff in the water all the time now. It might be fish poo, it might be dust, it might be particles, it might be where fish have come in and fed in silt and kicked it up in the air. Eventually that settles down, and that covers the surface of the bottom of the lake. So where you've got your black silt and your dead stuff, on top of that, you have a very, very light colouring. And if you remember, you and I did a feature for Carpology, it's probably a couple of 3 years ago now, where we went up to Baden Hall.
Yeah.
And the colour of the silt up there was almost like desert camouflage colour.
Yeah, it was yellowy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like a yellow. Now, in the Cotswolds, it's golden. To the east of Birmingham, in a big seam running down all the way from Lichfield to the south of Birmingham, it's orange. When you go down to Essex, it's orange or yellow. Obviously, it would have to be in Essex. It would have to be orange. I think it's just been for a spray can. And then when you go to Bedford and those areas around there, it goes yellow again. Now, if you think about it, have a look at the local stone.
I was going to say, it must be to do with the natural minerals and stone.
Exactly that. It's absolutely exactly that. If you want to know what colour to camouflage your rigs, have a look at what the local stone is, because that will give you an idea on what the dust colour will be in the area. So all of this manufacturers, we have weedy green, we have silty black, and we have gravelly brown.
Yeah.
Has anybody ever seen gravel that isn't brown? And the answer is yes. Gravel is very, very rarely brown. How many shades of green are there?
Yeah. So we need fake bake. I'm going to come out with a new range.
So you know the name of it there. I'm a bit worried about that. You knew that fake tan was called fake bake.
I have a youngish girlfriend that relies on the stuff.
Fakes.
Relies on stuff at weekend. I make her sleep in the little one's room because it stinks. I'll never forget it. So, I mean, what about... we used to fish with all black stuff. I mean, that, originally everything was black in the early days. The stiff tubing that we used to get, the Bob Roberts stuff, was it, or something? All those little beads and clips, everything was black. The only place I've really used, we used to use the remember the khaki coloured corder tubing that you used to get? It was like almost see through, but not quite.
Yeah,
when I used to fish the Austell lakes, because they were clay, they were very yellowy. And
yes.
The corder stuff, it just vanished on the bottom there, like completely vanished. And I hadn't really thought about it until we did that Baden Hall thing, because that was quite yellowy orange. But you're saying if you're going to pick a colour to be somewhere close to most lakes, you're probably going to go an orangey.
You go lighter rather than darker, actually, which is exactly the opposite to what most people think. It's exactly the opposite. People think, oh yeah, it's going to be dark down there. The only reason you see black silt is when you stand on it with your wellies, you go through the crust and kick all the dead stuff from underneath, and the black stuff is dead, decaying detritus. So that's why you see it as a black cloud. But actually, on the surface, it's not like that. Now, one bloke raised a very interesting point with me at one of the last shows I did. I think it was the one where we launched Crowe's book. We did the show up there, and he said, yeah, but when they're feeding in the silt, surely they're digging into it and they're kicking the black stuff up anyway. And it's quite funny because they don't dig that much into it normally. Sometimes they will, but a lot of the time they just pick off the top. So the cloud that you see is just the dust rising.
Yeah.
So, unless they're really, really burrowing in, then they're not kicking that much up. And the smoke screen that you see coming up is the surface inch or so, which is the lighter stuff rather than the darker stuff down underneath. Now, you might turn around then and say, well, the fish do dig a little bit deeper. Occasionally they do, but if they're picking baits off, if you're fishing that deep in the silt, the chances are that you need to present your bait that deep in the silt. You're not going to be catching that many. If you're fishing on the surface and presenting maggots on the surface, the fish aren't digging in for the maggots. What they're doing is they're sucking the maggots off the top, so they're only disturbing the surface layers.
Yeah.
There's another myth. Let's go through a couple of quick myths as well.
Yeah.
Maggots, if you use them over the silt, they burrow into it. Absolute rubbish. No, they don't. Never seen it. Never seen it. They don't vanish. No, they sit on top of the silt and drown.
Right.
So that's what they do. So if you were to stick a PVA bag of maggots out, it would probably spread to the size of possibly a dinner plate. The odd super fit racing maggot might get a bit further away, but the majority of the time they just go round and round in circles and eventually run out of steam and suffocate. If you're fishing over gravel, then they will go underneath the gravel. But silt, they don't burrow into it. They can't. They're not strong enough. They've got air in their sacks anyway. They're almost neutral buoyants. They'll sink, but they're not heavy enough to sink into it themselves. They have to burrow into it, and they don't. They crawl along it and disappear. Oh, another good one. What about Bloodworm then? Bloodworm sticking itself out of the silt and waving around like beds of seaweed. I've only been diving 15 years, three times a week, and I've never seen that.
Right.
So if the man that invented that little myth can come forward and show me some evidence of it, I'll be very impressed, because I've never, ever seen that.
So the Bloodworm are underneath, are they?
They're underneath, yeah. They're underneath that surface crust, and they live in the dead stuff, because Bloodworm, like any other worm, likes to sort of live in the detritus, and it likes dead stuff, because what it does, that's where it gets its food and nutrition. So generally, if occasionally they will pop out, but they're not out all the time filtering, like yep. people think they are. You know, they spend the majority of their lives buried in the dark silt at the bottom. If you cast out and you hook a Bloodworm,
yeah.
then what you can assume straight away is, for a start, it'll be in black silt, and secondly, that silt is going to be relatively deep.
I was going to say, so you must have plugged deep in the silt.
Yes. Yeah.
When I used to fish the Shropshire Maze, especially coal maze, like wherever you landed, there was Bloodworm. Like
yes.
almost every time you reeled in, you would have a Bloodworm somewhere between the lead and the hook. The kind of hot spots, or there was no hot spots, there weren't many carp, but the kind of places we would choose is when you pulled it in, there was three around the lead and three on yes. the hook, you know, they were the sort of dense places. But you're saying I was probably buried on most of those occasions when I was pulling
it. Yeah, I would say so. The one exception, and I've been quite general when I've been talking about silt not being black, if we're looking at exceptions, and let's look at how many Shropshire Meres there are in comparison with how many lakes there are around the country. The silt in Shropshire Lakes and in Cheshire Meres and in Old Ice Age Meres, particularly when you've got lots of trees around it, does tend to be darker. So it will be a grey colour almost to a black.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's they're about the only places where you will see darker silt. And it's sort of more or less peculiar, really, to Cheshire and Shropshire in that sort of area. Everywhere else, certainly gravel pits, they're not dark in the slightest. But if you've got a lot of leaf going in there, then that's ideal for Bloodworm, because as the leaf breaks down, not necessarily this last season's leaf, but probably this seasons before, after it's been covered up by silt over the top of it, that's what they love to eat, and that's what they that's where they'll tend to be. So if you're picking Bloodworm up, you can almost certainly assume that they're a couple of 3 inches below the surface.
And with the craze in zigs in recent years, we had Ali Ali Hamidi on the last show, and he loves using zigs as a kind of a preferred method these days. He's saying, you know, the carp, they only drop to eat, and they spend, you know, 90% the rest of the time midwater somewhere. From everything you've seen, I mean, would you think that you'd catch more if you only fish zigs or only fished on the bottom? Which one would catch the most fish all year round?
I think you'd probably catch more up in the water.
Right.
I think you know, that's not a definite, because the reason people don't use zigs and don't catch as many on zigs is that they don't give it a proper go.
Yeah.
And certainly, and I'll be gentle with this, but gentlemen of a certain age, i.e. me and you, and others of us that grew up fishing when zigs weren't invented, zig fishing seems a little bit alien. I think if you speak to your average 20-year-old, it's an absolutely completely natural form of their carping environment. You know, are we on zigs or are we on the deck? Doesn't make any difference to them. It's just another method. Whereas I think as soon as you go over 30, then zigs become a little bit alien. And as soon as you get them over 40, people say they don't count.
Yeah, I've said that.
You know, what a load of rubbish. If you've caught it in the mouth with a hook and you've reeled it in and it's ended up in your landing net, it counts, my friend.
Of course.
So it doesn't matter what you've done to get it out, it counts. Now, if you feel that using a piece of flip-flop doesn't work for you, then don't use one. But what I would suggest is that zigs will almost certainly catch fish when bottom baits won't.
Yeah.
Unquestionably. I had a very interesting conversation with Dave Lane, actually, not wanting to name drop, but it was funny. He got in touch with me talking about thermoclines.
Yeah.
And he wanted to know my opinion on thermoclines. And he was writing a piece for Total Carp, which completely coincidentally, I was writing one for both Improve Your Course Fishing as an easy guide and also for Carpology as a little bit more technical about the very same thing, because obviously this time of year it's quite interesting and quite important. Now, Dave's just started fishing Bundys. He's got a winter ticket on there and he's been after fish out of Bundys.
Yeah.
And he's a very shrewd bloke, Dave Lane. He picks things up very, very quickly. And, you know, he hasn't got the ability of going underwater and having a look at these things, but immediately it's like, right, it's the middle third that seems to be the kill zone with Zigrigs in particular.
Yeah.
And if you split a lake into its thermal stratification, which is another word for it's warm, it's cold, and it's hot water.
Yeah.
In the winter, the water at the surface is colder than the water underneath it. Yeah. In the summer, it's the other way around. So cold water sinks.
Yeah.
Cold water sinks until it reaches 4 degrees. As soon as it cools further than 4 degrees, it rises back up again. And it's a real strange anomaly with water, but it's at its densest at 4 degrees. And then as soon as it goes to 3, it becomes less dense. Now, the easiest way to test whether or not I'm telling the truth is get a piece of ice, which is 0 degrees water, and put it in a glass of water, which is whatever the temperature of the water is. And the ice will float.
Yeah.
And the reason it floats isn't because it's solid. It's just because the water at 0 degrees is less dense than it is at 4 degrees. So at the bottom of the lake, it's always going to be 4 degrees. In between the 4 degree layer at the bottom and the surface, it's going to be changing according to whatever that surface temperature is. So if the air temperature outside the lake is 7 degrees, as it's been now, the chances are the surface of the lake is going to be slightly warmer than 4 degrees.
Yeah.
If it's 0 degrees outside, then the chances are the water is going to be 1 degree or hovering just above freezing. So in the surface foot, you have an area that changes very, very quickly, both diurnally, which means between day and night. At night, obviously, it's cold. In the day, it's warm. So that surface foot can change very, very quickly. Underneath the foot, that's where it becomes slightly more static. As you get to sort of 2 and 3 foot, the water there at 3 foot deep is relatively well insulated from whether it's hot or cold above.
Yeah, it's much more static.
Yes. Now, also at that level, what you get is you get the thermal radiation of the sun coming down through the light. So the light waves go in, and actually, until they hit something, they don't have any effect on the water because the water cools itself. But if a fish's body, particularly the surface of a carp, which if you have a look at a carp from the top, it's dark. If you have a look at it from the bottom, it's light.
Yeah.
That's nature's way of camouflaging it. If a predator looks down, it's camouflaged against the bottom. If a predator looks up, it's camouflaged against the sky.
Yeah.
So it has a dark surface. Now, the reason they come up to the surface and normally sit a couple of feet below the surface is because they're outside of that cold layer at the top, but they're picking up the thermal effects of the sun, which when it hits them will warm their backs up. So if you're zig rigging at this time of year, ideally on a flat day, you want to be 2 foot below the surface, I would say.
Yeah.
Perhaps a little bit closer, depending if it's flat calm. If it's windy, then drop it down a little bit more. You don't want to be too close to the bottom, because remember, the bottom of it is going to be 4 degrees.
Yeah.
So depending on what the temperature's been doing in the recent time, that area might be warmer or colder just above it. Which is why the middle third is the best place to go, because you're getting the thermal radiation from sun going through the clear water and hitting it towards the surface layers, but you're also getting the benefit that it's not changing temperature very often.
It makes complete sense. My mind's a little bit blown, actually. That's it's just, I don't know, I can just picture everything that you're saying, and it's kind of answered what I've always suspected. There's nothing more satisfying than finding a nice spot to fish on, putting a load of bait out on it and catching off it. But I've kind of toyed with the idea for a few years now that I would catch way more if I did, you know, if I zigged, if I find a way of fishing, you know, from so, when I have zigged, it's 2 foot below the surface generally has always been the key spot for me. And for the actual man hours I've spent fishing compared to, you know, zigging compared to on the bottom, my catch rate is massive, you know, and I still don't. I still do it half-heartedly, and I still catch.
Well, I think now if any time is the time to try a zig, really, from the beginning of March through till the beginning of May,
and in that middle zone.
Oh, absolutely, middle and up.
Yeah.
So, you know, pick the top two thirds, discount the bottom third. Pick the top two thirds, and if it's a nice warm day, come higher. Don't come right to the surface though, because it'll still be chilly up there, because the night means that it'll chill down. If anybody gets the opportunity, and I'm going to go with a completely gratuitous plug now, but if anybody gets the opportunity, get yourself a copy of this month's Carpology. There's a photograph in there, and I'll bring it up to the Northern Show as well if anybody's coming along to that, and we'll put the shot on. I've also got video footage of it. I've got a shoal of roach sitting just underneath the hypolimnium, which is the posh name for that surface area of water.
Yep.
And the top foot, there is absolutely nothing in. It's an underwater shot looking across this deck of fish. The fish is at shoal. They're only small roach with skimmers underneath them. There are probably, well, I don't know, between 5,000 and 10,000 fish, loads of them there. You know, when you get a great big ball of razor blades.
Yep.
And I tell you what, the surface of them looks like a table. You could put a tablecloth across it. It's that flat.
Wow.
And it's about a foot below the surface, because that's the area where the change is too quick.
So do you think one of the reasons why the carp get really active when it's super windy is because it's messing this all up? It's mashing, it's evening through the layers. I mean,
absolutely. There's a big mix goes in. And also it combines obviously with low pressure. Normally, if you've got a big wind, generally it's a low pressure.
Yeah.
And the low pressure is a bit more kind on them. Interestingly, what Laney said was about zigs, because there seems to be a general rule of thumb, and this is completely unproven, it's just what people seem to think, that if it's high pressure, go up in the water, if it's low pressure, go down. And as carp anglers, we've picked that up from trout anglers, because generally the trout, when it's a high pressure day, they'll take a dry fly or they'll take one on a light dropper. Alternatively, if it's a low pressure day, they tend to be a little bit further down, so they'll fish a heavier dropper and they'll nymph for them.
Yeah.
So as a result, we've picked it up, transferred it to carp fish, and said that's right. Laney's view is that if it's high pressure, you can go up in the air. If it's low pressure, you can get on the deck and feed them down there because they'll have it. Or alternatively, some of his best zig rig captures have been in the bottom end of that upper third in low pressure storms.
Wow.
Now, you imagine you're fishing a big wind. There's a fairly hefty breeze blowing around. My mind absolutely is about getting it on the deck and getting the grub in front of them.
Yeah.
But actually, they've got to move there. And when they move there, they'll move in that middle corridor.
So you're thinking literally popped up off the lead, you know, a foot and a half off the lead or something would probably
depending on what the water temperature is. You know, if it's 6 foot, not the temperature, the depth.
Yeah.
If it's 6 foot deep, you want to be fishing between 2 and 4 foot. If it's 20 foot deep, you want to be fishing between 7 and 14 feet.
Yeah.
But that middle third is where it is. You know, interestingly, in the bleak midwinter, and we haven't really had a bleak midwinter now, but in the bleak midwinter, and a lot of the lads on the small ponds have been finding this out as well, a 12 to 18 inch zig or a pop-up just off the deck is absolutely marvellous. Now, I'm talking 4 to 6 foot deep, man-made, fairly high-stocked ponds. And there's an awful lot of them around. You know, Todberman is a prime example, Acorns, Blackthorn, all of these style places where the farmer thinks, right, I'm going to dig a four-acre pond and shove it full of carp.
Yeah.
Then generally they tend not to be more than 6 foot deep, primarily because there's a lot of soil comes out of a hole 6 foot deep and they haven't got anywhere to put it. So they don't normally go more than 6 foot. They don't want to go much shallower than that, because if they lose 2 foot in the winter, in the summer because of drought, they've only got 4 foot of water, which isn't enough. So a lot of the time these ponds are between sort of 5 and 8 foot deep.
Yeah.
6 foot, perfect depth. 2 foot zigs are just off the bottom. And where they're sitting, I would absolutely, I'd bet as much money as you'd want me to put on it, they're sitting at the top end of the 4 degree static water, or the bottom end of the slightly warmer water just above it. That's exactly where they'll be sitting, 12 to 18 inches off, and that's the bottom of the middle third, or the top of the bottom third, in the very, very bleak midwinter, when it's really cold above them. But other than that, they're just coming up and higher off the bottom.
It makes complete sense, and it's... I like fishing my bait. I like finding spots. You know, that was one of my edges, was being able to, find tiny holes and fish effectively on top of them, or as effective as I think we're fishing. And I don't know. I suspect the bait companies don't like this zigging, because I think if we all knew the actual facts, you know, why would we go and spend £1,000 a year on bait? You know, we can fish with, flip flops for the rest of the year.
Yeah,
obviously catch as many fish.
Yeah, ultimately, you know, if you speak to anybody that knows what they're talking about when they practice the noble art of the angle, location is one of the most important things.
Yeah.
you know, you can, and unless you have unlimited funds and very, very good access to pre-beta leg constantly,
yeah,
then the chances are location is the most important thing. Now, that can be warped, and that can be warped by angler pressure. That can be warped by bait. That can be warped by climatic conditions. But, you know, your style of fishing suited what you did very, very well, because you're going out and you're targeting individual big fish and you're after that one specific fish. So as a result, what you're trying to do is find out where it lives, or alternatively get some bait out and get it to come into one individual spot.
Yeah.
The majority of carp fishermen aren't, they're not doing that. Just as they're not fishing the Cheshire Mares or whatever, they're going out and they're getting a few bites. So if you want to go out and get bites, or you want to catch fish, what you want to do is put yourself in a position where you're on as many fish as you possibly can do. So let's have a look at location, location, location again. You've got to get out and you've got to get where the fish are. Now, they might be at the bottom end of the pond where the wind's blowing, but unfortunately there's another six blokes there.
Yeah.
So what you're going to do is you're going to share them. However, not all the fish in the pond are going to be there. They're going to be somewhere else, or they're going to be moving around, or alternatively, those six are going to pressure them out of that area or put them on guard. So when they move out of there, where are they going to go to, and how are they going to get there?
Yeah.
And the majority of the time, when they get there, they're not crawling along on the bellies, pulling themselves along by the pec fins. They're up in the water somewhere, swimming there.
This is what I mean. It's going to take a lot of the, you know, if you just spent the whole season fishing, I don't know, on an average 8 to 12 foot depth lake, and you just put 2 6-foot zigs out for the entire season somewhere near the fish, like,
yes,
you know, you're probably going to catch pretty consistently. And we know how fish move about a lake. You know, I've seen them go a mile and a half, 2 miles. You know, in a blink of an eye, you know, your mate's at one end of the lake and he's on all the fish, and I think, yeah, they're going to come up here at night. Before you know it, they're not in front of you, and he doesn't even know they've gone, you know, up the other end of the lake. And the fact is, if you pick somewhere in the middle, if they're doing that on a daily or even hourly basis sometimes, you know, you pick somewhere in the middle and fish halfway, you're probably going to not have to worry about all the other little things that skilled anglers have been trying to get right for since, you know, carp fishing began. You're kind of taking a lot of the guesswork out of the equation. It's you could, you know, the old broken clock syndrome, where the broken, you know, stop clock's right twice a day.
Yeah,
you could probably sit at mid depth in any middle peg on the lake and fish there all year and probably catch as many as the really good anglers that are hunting them down, you know, moving every day, or, you know.
I think it ultimately depends on what you want to do. Now, I'll say one thing first before I move on to the next thing I'm going to say. Cool, there's an obvious statement. If you haven't learned to zig rig fish, do it. Mm. Because it isn't all about zigs, just as it isn't all about the surface or isn't all about the bottom. If you want to be a good angler, what you've got to do is you've got to be adaptable.
Yeah.
And if having to catch fish tomorrow means chucking a zig out, if you've never done it before, you're not going to be confident. And what you'll do is exactly what I did when I started, and the lads still take the mickey at me for the way that I used to zig fish. I chop a piece of foam into something the size of a carrot, chuck it out at some indeterminable depth, somewhere between the bottom and the top, leave it out there for an hour, not have a bite, not be confident in it, reel it in, and then moan and say, you know what, I've tried everything.
Yeah.
And I'll stick my hands up and say, I said that. And I hadn't tried everything, because what I'd done is I had absolutely appallingly fished a zig rig in the wrong place for a very short period of time, then dismissed it because I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So what I then started doing was going, I went down to a local water by me called Shearwater, by where I'm living now, where there are absolutely stacks of fish that are starving hungry. And I learned how to spot over zigs. And then I learned how to fish normal zigs in clear water. Now, there's two very distinct ways of fishing zigs. One will be trapping, and the other one, I believe, is hunting. Now, trapping, you're getting them to come to you, so you're sticking a bit yellow bit of foam out, ideally, and sticking a load of stuff over the top of it, and that stuff will be a smelly amount of bits that float, bits that sink, and a load of yellow cloud that will stick in the area. And what you're trying to do there is create a feeding effect in the upper layers of the water where the fish are battling over the bait that's falling out of the spot.
Yeah.
Great on high-density venues, absolutely fantastic and devastating. be as accurate as you can do, fish it a couple of feet under the surface wherever, and see what happens. You'll catch them, but stick with it. The other one, which is a big fish sig method, is fishing clear water at this time of year with a single solitary black sig. And what you're doing is you're trapping them. You're just trying to hope that one will stumble across you.
Yeah.
And you know, it works. But go out and do it. Build your confidence. Go out to an easy water first and build your confidence. But just to go on to the second point here, this winter, and people say, oh, you're a sheep, you're going out and you're doing this drop shotting for perch. I am. I don't care. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
So have a word with yourself if you have a problem with what I do. You should be concentrating on what you're doing, not what I'm doing. I've had a limited amount of time this winter. I want to get my fishing fixed, and I've gone out, and I absolutely love catching perch on the drop shot. And I've seen a few blokes that have gone out, and they're catching them on the worm, and they're catching them on the shrimp, and they're catching them on the prawn, and they've had threes. And you know what? I've had a few over two. I've had loads of ones, and I've had even more singles, effectively. And people say, oh, you want to do this? You want to do that? You want to do the other? You know what? Yeah. I don't.
I want to do
yeah, exactly. I want to go out and I want to catch perch on the drop shot using very, very fine rods, very fine line, very fine hooks. And when I catch one that's 12 ounces or above, you know what? It doesn't half pull back.
Yeah.
And you can keep your threes. I'm not interested in chucking a feeder of worms out to catch a 3-pounder. That offers me no benefit whatsoever. If I want to do that, you know what? I'll chuck a carp rod out and catch something that will pull back even more. What I'm interested in is going out and fishing with finesse for something that I really want to fish for.
Yeah, we have a section on the show called Carp Are Not Sheep, and we focus on the latest trends. And can't remember if it's the first or second show, Mark, where we did drop shotting, and Mark admitted to having his drop shotting rod in the back of the motor at the time. It must have been the first show, actually. And I actually bought a rod this week. So
oh, it's brilliant.
I'm going to be doing it. I'm going to be doing it very soon. It gets back to our point at the start of it. We do this because we love it. We do it because we enjoy it. And, you know, whichever style of fishing you do for carp or for other species, you know, the key point is that you're doing it because you want to do it and you're getting enjoyment out of it. And nobody has the right to tell you you're doing it wrong or you shouldn't be doing this. Or as long as you're not harming anybody else or the fish, then stuff them all.
Absolutely. I think, and I have, I have a very simple ethos on life. And oh, I sound like a man of sage wisdom now. But I have a very, very simple outlook on life. And that I think the world's problems could be sorted with just one thing. And that one thing is respect. And, you know, you respect yourself in the way that you carry yourself, what you do, how you do it. Yeah. You respect other people. If you want to do something, that's absolutely fine by me. As long as you're not disrespecting anybody else, then fine. And you respect that around you. Be that other people's possessions, be that other people's water, be it nature, be it the environment, whatever. Just show a little respect. Hopefully get that respect back. The world will be a much better place.
And on that note, what a way to finish. And it's especially the last half an hour. I feel like I've certainly learned something. And I'm excited. I'm excited to get out there and get the zigs on. And I'd like to thank you for being on the Carpcast.
Brilliant. No problem at all. Lovely speaking to you as ever, Jamie. And yeah, hope to see you soon.
We'll see you in a few weeks at the Northern Angling Show, 28th of March.
And, yeah, if anybody wants to know anything at all about the underwater world, then I should be doing a show there, I think on the Sunday, isn't it? So yeah, feel free to come up and have a chat.
Yep, hosting the Saturday and doing an underwater talk on the Sunday. Or is it underwater? About whatever you choose.
Fantastic.
Cool. Thank you very much, Rob.
Cheers, Jay. Look after yourself. See you soon.
Cheers, pal.